Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
When it comes to child support, many brothers and sisters just come to the conclusion that I'm just done. There is nothing I can do. They got me. Well, what we need to understand is this whole system is bogus, believe it or not. And for proof of that, why don't you send for my free articles? We'll also send one good audio clip and one good solid video clip to you. And by the time you listen to this and read this, you will clearly understand that there is a way out. You can send that to taraka53@hotmail.com. That's taraka53@hotmail.com, and I'll rush that right straight to you. Don't hesitate to visit my website, www.newdebtelimination.com. For information on us, go to www.newdebtelimination.net. Don't hesitate to call me, area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's not over. It's just what you know. Living in a constant state of fear has never been good. Many of us fear the Internal Revenue Service. We don't know what to do about it. For one reason, we don't know what it is. Send for my free reports to taraka53@hotmail.com. That's taraka53@hotmail.com. We'll send our articles to you. We'll also send one good solid video that should do it once and for all about exercising your freedom of right to travel. And our second video shows you exactly what to do with your writ of habeas corpus, how to deal with these people in the courtroom, and what to send these people and how to respond to them. Send that to taraka53@hotmail.com, or you can call me, area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Don't hesitate to visit our website, taraka53@hotmail.com. That's the email website, www.newdebtelimination.com. Freeing up capital to make investments may not be as hard as you think. For those of you who have Facebook accounts, send me a friend request over there on Facebook and LinkedIn to Taraka Amana Elbay. That's T-A-R-A-H-A-K-A. Amana is A-M-A-A-N-A and then E-L and of course B-E-Y. And you'll be able to see the actual documents clearly showing you how I was able to cancel my mortgage and property taxes contracts, and that way I have freed up capital for investments. To get the apparatus to do this with, go to www.newdebtelimination.com. That's www.newdebtelimination.com. It's not as hard as you think. Send a friend request on Facebook, and I'll grant that request so you can actually see the documents for yourself. Peace.
Welcome, Morris and Morris Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Taraka Amana Elbay, and this evening we have a very, very informative broadcast tonight. There is no doubt about it. Our special guest will be Michael I.M. Hotep of the African History Network. Now, this brother here travels all over the United States doing speaking engagements. He have done engagements and interviewed some of the most important and influential people of African descent inside the United States. He also is the host of the African History Network show. I know a lot of you are familiar with it, for those of you who are not, the brother's broadcast comes on at night and in the day, and he put out some very, very fantastic information and very informative information as far as our ancient culture is concerned. Michael I. M. Hotep will be our special guest. He'll be coming in this evening, and we will conduct an interview with the brother, and we'll be talking about our ancient history as well as our current events inside the United States, okay? So make sure that you hold on to your hat and stay tuned to this broadcast. What we're going to do here this evening is we're going to deal with some very, very important information. We're going to lay some groundwork here for something that has pretty much baffled the world for centuries. How did the ancient Kemetans, or the people you're calling Egyptian, no such people, but how did the ancient Egyptians build the pyramids? How was it possible for them to move these gigantic stones and stack them one on top of each other with this type of precision where you can't even put a slip of paper between these rocks? How was that possible? How do you lift stones weighing tons and stack them all the way up in the air? How was that done? What do we have any clue or any evidence of how they did that? And what we're going to do here this evening is I'm going to make an attempt to expose some information on the possibility of how that may have been done, okay? We have some stuff that we're going to bring to you this evening. I don't know if many of you have been to Florida, but if you have been to Florida and you have missed anything on Coral Castle, I suggest that you come back and make it your business to Castle and take a look around. There was a gentleman many years ago that built a castle, and the stones that he moved by himself, now, keep in mind, he didn't have none of his buddies, none of his partners, nobody over there with him, but the stones that he stacked one atop another to build his castle with weighed twice as much as the stones that they used to build the Great Pyramids. Now, I know that seems phenomenal. Right here in the state of Florida, in Homestead, Florida, it was originally in Florida City, and then it moved to Homestead, Florida, Coral Castle exists. And you can come and see this for yourself. And it has been an enigma. People have been trying to find out how did he do this. Now, he had a habit of not letting people see how he done this. It was amazing how he was able to avoid detection for so long, but nevertheless, the guy got it done. He stacked the stones up, built this castle, and what we're going to do is do an investigation on that and touch on some things that may shed some light on how our ancient ancestors built the pyramids of ancient Kemet. Okay? Now, if you have some questions, you can go ahead and raise your hand. I'll answer them as best I can. But I'm just as baffled as you until I got a hold of this information. Also, off the coast of Florida, 40 miles off the coast of Florida, in the Atlantic Ocean, is a 400-foot-high pyramid. Now, I said this on a previous broadcast, and a young man went and Googled this thing, and he found this, and he sent me the article because they messed around and put it in the paper at one time. And but if you come down here to Florida, you can go out into the ocean. The fishermen will take you out into the ocean and show you this thing. At certain times of the season, it is clearly visible where you can see it. If you like to scuba dive or whatever and go down and actually see this thing, you can do this. As far as coming to visit Coral Castle, the admission is only $10. $10 to come in and take a look at this thing. And but what I would recommend you do before you come down here to take a look at this, go ahead and Google this information, Coral Castle, and also go on YouTube and check it out over there, too, after this broadcast. We're going to lay this information out for you this evening, and our guest, Michael Imhotep, will be coming with us. He's informed me earlier that he had a very present engagement, so he will be here approximately 8:30. But in the meantime, the show goes on. So what we're going to do is we're going to, in a moment, we're going to be exposing this information about Coral Castle. And I suggest you pay very close attention to the clues that is laid out and the things that is going to be said during this particular interview. Okay? You can verify this information. This has been out for quite some time. There's been a lot of people who has attempted to find out how did this guy do this. It's been amazing to see him, how he put this thing together, okay? But he did it. And so what we're going to do here today is we're going to lay it out so that we can get this information and we can learn how it's done, okay? So you all hold your hat, and we will be right back.
Hey, baby.
When you get my love,
no
Hi, I'm Tahaka Amana L. Bay. There's some very important things that we need to consider when dealing with police stops. First of all, does failure to wear a seat belt constitute a breach of the peace? Is it a public nuisance? Is there an injured party? If a policeman stops you, is he an officer of the law? Has he taken a public oath of office? Is he a public official? Criminal impersonation in the first degree is a felony. In order to exercise your freedom of rights successfully, contact me, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Send an email to Tahaka53@hotmail.com.
All right, Morris, we're back. Now, we're going to be coming up with some more informative information in the near future after this broadcast. We will be dealing with relationships between the brothers and sisters, and we will also deal with the zodiac astrology aspect as well. So I want you all to tune into these broadcasts. For those of you who are having problems with debt, give me a call or send me an email to tahaka53@hotmail.com, or you can call me at area code 904-303-9061. That's 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We have been having quite a bit of success here. I had a sister called me this morning, and I said she's going to tune in tonight, but she got a confirmation from the bank letting her know that her mortgage has been canceled. And this is what it's all about, getting the job done. We ain't just talking about it. We out here on the pavement taking care of business. If you're a serious problem, you want the problem solved, don't hesitate to contact us. Go over there to my website, check everything out, newdebtelimination.com. If you need to know more about what we do, go to www.newdebtelimination.net. That's our information site. You can go there and check that out as well. Brother Michael I.M. Hotep is a native of lifelong brother from Detroit. He's a graduate of Class Technical High School, holds a Bachelor of Science degree in Business Administration with a major in Marketing from Wayne State University. It was at Wayne State in the early 1990s that he started studying African history, culture, spirituality, and entrepreneurship. The seeds for the African History Network were laid at this time. Some of his biggest influences are Dr. Leonard Jeffries, Anthony T. Browder, Dr. Yusuf Ben Jochanan, Dr. John Henry Clark, Booker T. Coleman, Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X, Earl Graves Sr., Dr. Claude Anderson, Lister Belt Middleton, former host of the TV show For the People, and Dr. Ray Higgins of the African Village. He has 17 years sales, marketing, and management experience and has managed a business consulting and training company for 7 years. He has taught entrepreneurship for 6 years and has taught a community college as well as nonprofit organizations using his entrepreneurial skills. He created the African History Network in 2009 as a way to help his people. Keep in mind, brothers and sisters, that he'll be coming in here this evening, and on the 19th, which is this coming Thursday, I will be a guest on the African History Network, so make sure you tune in and make sure you got your pencil and paper so when we start firing, you'll be able to have this information and write it down so you can handle your debts or whatever it is that you're going to need to do. That's going to be on the Thursday on the African History Network show. That will be, I will come in approximately 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's when I'm scheduled to come in, and then we will go from there. Okay? But now, without further ado, we're going to deal with some things.
Back in 1923, a Latvian, Edward Leed Skolnin, started building what we know as Coral Castle in Florida City, Florida. It was an amazing structure. Just how he did it remains a great mystery. Back in 1936, then, he decided to move that to Homestead, Florida, the entire castle. In a moment, Joe Bullard joins us. His work, Waiting for Agnes, with an updated theory from Joe on what he thinks happened at Coral Castle, next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Well, as I mentioned, we're talking about Coral Castle now and the work of the late Edward Leed Skolnin. Joe Bullard, Joe wrote the book Waiting for Agnes. He was born in Florida himself in 1951, attended the University of West Florida, graduated with a bachelor's degree in journalism back in 74. He found out about the Coral Castle on a television series, In Search Of. You remember that, with Leonard Nimoy. And in September of 1984, during the time that he was working at Lake City Community College as a public information director and a professor of a newspaper class, Joe spent 10 years of research at Coral Castle as he then started writing Waiting for Agnes. And he was on with me a couple of years ago. And Joe, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show, my friend. How are you?
George, thank you. It is wonderful to be back in the Nori Zone.
Excellent. And family doing well? Everybody good?
Everybody's great.
Super. Let's review for a lot of new listeners who don't know about Coral Castle and Edward Leed Skolnin, and give us an overview of this structure and an overview of Ed.
Basically, George, what we have here is Ed was from Latvia, which is one of the Baltic states near Russia with Estonia and Lithuania. Now, Ed grew up as a child with a sort of not an emphysema, but he was unhealthy. He was premature. He was born 30 days before his time, and basically he grew up, he quit school in the fourth grade because he just couldn't get there, and he fell in love with a girl named Agnes Scuffs. He was 26, she was 16. At the time, he and his grandfather, I believe, had a quarry business and where they would take and make tombstones, so they didn't make a lot of money in those days, but Ed didn't get out to play with much children, so he only loved this one girl, and when Ed did something, George, he was like you and I. He just had such passion for life and for his work. Well, the night before the wedding, she was 16, he was 26. She didn't really give him a good reason, but she just said, I can't marry you, and she jilted him the night before the wedding. Now, some people, George, have the ability to move on from these things, and as you discover in the book later on, Ed is diagnosed with a condition called cryptoamnesia, which we can get into later if you'd like to. But anyway, it's a condition where some people who handle trauma differently, and they go into their books and their lives, and they can't go out into the real world. Well, I think this is what happened to Ed, because he basically just wandered around after she jilted him, and he went to Canada and worked in a lumber mill there for about 4 years. Well, he didn't know it at the time, but he developed tuberculosis. His health was bad, so with a walking stick, which was called a witching rod, which he doused for water, he began walking from Canada, I understand, in the snow. If you can imagine this, he walks all the way from Canada. He comes down through Chaco Canyon, through Texas, through all these places. Well, when he lands at the edge of the Florida Everglades, which is called Florida City, he passes out on the side of the road. He's found by a local real estate or farmer there. They take him in the house, take him to the doctor. They discover he's only got 4 to 6 months to live. Basically, in this time, he gets a little stronger, eats some vegetable soup, and so he explains to the people that he'd like to have a junkyard and get some tools. So he starts going to the junkyard and taking these tools, George. Everything is formed by hand, and he starts building a castle. And they explain to him, well, if you only have 4 to 6 months to live, why would you build a castle? And he said, well, I have my own reasons. Well, George, he cuts out some stones, some round stones, mounts them on the wheel bearings of a 1918 Ford truck, spins it around, puts a pyramid on top of it with a blue glass. Weird things going on here, electromagnetic waves. He goes back to the doctor. In 6 months, there's not a trace of tuberculosis in his body.
Gone. Totally gone.
He is the only person in history that we know of, verified, documented, totally beat tuberculosis. Now, in 1918, which I forgot to give the time, this was 1918, when you got tuberculosis, terribly, terribly contagious, and you died from it. So he beats tuberculosis. Then, George, he puts these iron soles on his Brogan boots, gets an old bicycle with no tires, just the rims, and starts pedaling around Homestead. Well, they start calling him Crazy Ed, because who would ride a bicycle without tires? And, you know, as we learned from one of the people that were down there later on, you know, they told me, they said, well, one of the reasons he was doing that was when he had the tuberculosis was the tires hitting the rocks and the stones down there, the metal was causing electricity to flow through his body, and they believe that helped him to be stronger. So he wasn't just crazy driving around without tires. That was the way that he healed himself. So now, as he's building Coral Castle in Florida City, people would try to sneak up at night. He only worked from midnight till 6 in the morning. So he would, you know, basically work
and, with the and by himself. He worked by himself, right?
Totally alone. You know, people today don't believe that, but there's over 300 documents at Coral Castle that verify everything was done alone. But, George, he had a special gift, and that was the gift of a sixth sense. Now, I talked to the old-timers down there, and they said, we would get down, Joe, and low crawl like an alligator, which they're all familiar with down there in the Everglades because they're everywhere. And we would low crawl, get within 100 yards or 50 yards of the castle. Ed would pop up on a wall and go, how are you doing tonight? I can't work until you leave. And it would spook them so bad, George, they would leave. Now, it is known Ed was crazy about children. He only allowed children around at night. Now, one of the strange things, what the mystery at Coral Castle is, okay, we got stones there that average weight twice as heavy as the Great Pyramid. What was he trying to tell us? The average weight of the Great Pyramid stone is 3 tons. Ed's stones are 6 tons. What he was telling us, George, I understand. I have broken the secret code of the Great Pyramid and Stonehenge. Okay.
He once said that he knew the secrets of the pyramids, didn't he?
Yes, the Pyramid Stonehenge. And another important thing that a lot of people overlook is he mentioned the Peruvians.
Explain for a moment, Joe, what the two children who peered over his little fence gate, what have you, and saw him moving some stones.
Now, this is where it gets really fascinating, George. The children come up there at night. Now, remember, Ed had the sixth sense, so he knew they were there. But we believe that he allowed them to see him at work. Now, this is the way they described it. They said, we saw blocks of stone, 18, 20 tons, 15 to 18 feet long, floating in the air. Now, they could only see in the darkness a little bit, maybe under a quarter moon. The stones floated up slowly over the wall and into the castle like hydrogen balloons.
Like hydrogen balloons.
Like hydrogen balloons. Now, the question is, how do you float those stones? And I have to insert something here real quickly. I got an email from a person right before this show, and they said, I don't know if you've seen this or not, but there was a young man, George, who, and this ties in with this, what we're talking about now. He committed suicide. He was 19 years old. And this lady was channeling him. How at 19 he knew these things, I don't know. But all of a sudden, in the middle of her questions, he said, by the way, since I'm no longer on the earth, I can give you the answers as to how the pyramids were built. And the channeler went, what? So he said, there was a man, this is documented, this person who was killed himself was named Eric. And he said, he's only 19. I thought he must be a coast listener. How else would he know about Coral Castle
right at
19? So he said, there's a man in Florida at Coral Castle, and he understood the secrets, and he'd researched it, of the pyramids. So the channeler got interested, and she said, well, how did he do it? And the person, Eric, said he created a surface resistance by changing the electromagnetic fields. Okay? And here's what's interesting. Our friend Christopher Dunn has the theory, remember, that Ed used his perpetual motion holder, the magnetic machine that he created to produce energy, and actually wrapped a coil of wire around a stone, flipped on this switch, and it created an anti-gravity field.
And he just kind of like floated it into place.
He floated it into place. Well, the next statement this Eric makes is he says, this man, Ed, and I'm quoting here, he made a machine using an old blueprint that would, float these stones and create the magnetic field. So perhaps Christopher Dunn was on the right track.
Now, when experts started looking at Coral Castle long after Lead Skolnin had died, they saw something, some kind of a apparatus that he had built, right? It was dismantled. What was that, Joe?
Okay. What he did, George, was he took telephone poles that were 60 feet tall, okay? And if you look down there now, you will see pictures of Ed. And at the top of this telephone pole is this strange-looking box. It looked just like a huge, long battery, okay? They believe that this was one of the things that was hooked to his perpetual motion holder, and when he flipped the switch, the energy went up to that box, and the box is the thing that flipped it over from positive and negative and caused, like the gentleman said, the resistance and changed the electromagnetic field. Now, when Ed got through with the castle, they no longer could find any of these tools. The only tools that he left behind, George, were the chisels and the chains and the hoist and all that kind of thing. But the important thing, the things we wanted to look for, like the box and everything, were gone.
Who took it? I mean, he died in a hospital. He was in the hospital for what, like 28 days or something like that?
Actually, he was in the hospital for 3 days. He went into a coma and died after the third day. Yeah.
Wow.
So
okay.
Now, thieves did break in after he died, and there was 3 days before the police and everything could get to the castle. A lot of things were stolen. They could have been stolen now, but I have a feeling, George, that Ed destroyed those things before those people came because he was that secretive. He didn't want you to know what his secrets were. So I think Ed himself, from what I can determine and the people that I interviewed, said, no, Ed destroyed that a long time before. He only wanted you to see the crude tools. He didn't want you to see anything that had been technology except for his perpetual motion holder.
What did he say, Joe, about magnetics?
This is what's fascinating, George. We've talked about this several times. Now, when they interviewed Edgar Cayce, he explained that the way they moved the stones of the Great Pyramid, and I'm going to answer that question too, in two and one, was Cayce made the statement that they took, the way they moved the stones was by the controlled manipulation of the resonant forces, the cosmic forces that would cause iron to float in water, stone also floats in the air. Now, if you go back and read all of Ed's books, he talks about the cosmic forces. Well, that sounds like a fancy term. What are the cosmic forces? Then he explains to you, because Ed loved complexity and he also loved simplicity. And the cosmic forces are simply the positive and negative forces of the magnet.
And he believed that an object, every object, had magnetism. It could be a stone, a piece of wood, metal. He just believed that magnetism was everywhere, right?
It's the total creative forces. Yes, everything has it. Everything from stones to sticks to when you burn a stick and it goes into the smoke, even the smoke has the electric, the positive and negative forces. He said, basically, if you talk to the physicists today and everything and you ask them, what is gravity? They look at you puzzled. Nobody can tell you what gravity is. Ed told us what gravity is. Gravity is the magnetic forces. That's all it is. It's the positive and negative from the North Pole and everything. That's what holds it together. That's why the moon can pull the tides together. Think about the strength of the moon pulling our ocean tides and waves only through magnetism.
So there's no question that Lead Skolnin had some incredible ability to move these stones. And when he moved, Joe, from Florida City to Homestead, didn't he hire a flatbed truck operator And he basically told the truck driver, go away, I'm going to take care of this on my own. And all those stones were loaded on the flatbed truck?
That is correct. There was an actual man there who had a truck that used to haul, they used to cut great cypress trees that weighed tons. So a man had a truck with the springs that would haul the weight. Ed knew that this truck could haul the weight of his stones. And, George, it took him a year to move it from Florida City to Homestead, and they had to move those stones one stone at a time. One stone there, Ed's heaviest stone, is 30 tons. Now, the truck driver, Ed would make him back up to the stone. He'd make him leave and then come back in, say, an hour, sometimes 3 hours, sometimes four, depending on what it was. Well, one day the guy was going to sneak up on him. So he low-crawled around the castle walls there after about 30 minutes, thinking he would find out how he did it. Ed was behind him and said, hey, Bob, I'm ready to move the stones. The guy jumped out of his pants, and he said, I was just trying to come help you. And Ed said, thank you, I don't need your help.
It's already done.
It's done. How do you move, George? No, and George, they have tried to move these stones with the heaviest equipment that we have today. They can't. They tried to lift a 10-ton stone. They can't even lift it. Now, they can drag it, but they cannot lift it.
It's truly a remarkable story. I mean, probably one of the best. Now, what made Lead Scaldin Joe move from Florida City to Homestead? Why did he move the entire castle?
Ed was a great – he had an answer for everything. He told everyone that he was too isolated. Well, also, to fill in that story also, George, Ed applied for a patent on the perpetual motion holder, which, by the way, would replace all of our combustible engines today. We could be running homes. This was the same idea that Tesla had. Ed wanted to give away free energy. He applies to the government for an energy machine, a patent on his energy machine. Well, they never would give it to him. About 6 weeks after he applied, this is what the locals told me. Some toughs came in, beat him up almost to death, and said, you know, we want the secrets to your machine. He would not give it to him. Well, right after that, he moves from Florida City to Homestead. He made out like he was too isolated. He wanted to get on 301 where the tourists are. And also he was scared to be alone in the woods there, scared he would get beat up again. Okay? But now the people who are studying this esoteric energy, which we've discussed before, which are the ley lines, which are points that the Great Pyramid is under, Stonehenge is under, Coral Castle, these lines, George, run all over the world. And if you can imagine just running PowerPoints, like running, our telephone wires and all that kind of stuff, it's like the energy that runs in wires, except there's no wires. It's just a natural energy. And Ed was tapping into these ley lines to get this energy. Now, people who have studied this believe that these lines can be disrupted by hurricanes, storms, tsunamis, earthquakes, anything that shakes the earth. Well, the PowerPoints in Florida City were weakening for some reason. We don't know what, if it was an earthquake somewhere in Tanganyika or one of those places. But anyway, it went along that fault line, interrupted it. Well, Ed recognized it. So what he wanted to do, George, was move the castle to Homestead where he had gone out with his witching rod. He always took his dowsing rod. He had to find water because water acts like the storage battery for this energy. So he went to Homestead walking. He found the PowerPoint energy where it was stronger, and that's when he started moving the castle. Of course, he would make out, like, instead of the scientific method he was using, he would use the excuse that, no, I'm just moving because of this reason. So he wouldn't tell us why, but he had to get to the PowerPoints in Homestead before the ones died out in Florida City.
And once he died, so went the secret?
Yes. He left hints behind, George. He kept telling people, you know, hey, it's all about magnets. It's all about, creating anti-gravity forces, you know, these type of things. But we still, George, the machine that sits down there, which is the essence of what Ed was about, would change our life. That machine sits there today collecting dust. The plans are there to build it. And the University of Florida, which I love those people, but they don't even send an engineering team. George, Coral Castle should be a university. Engineers should be going down there studying what he did. We could recreate that machine, George. We've been the people who've always used our technology and our brains, and we're letting something go to waste.
All right, we're going to come back, Joe, and talk about your new thoughts about how Lead Skolnin did all this. Welcome back. Joe Bullard with us. His book, of course, Waiting for Agnes, the story of Edward Lead Skolnin and Coral Castle. So, Joe, you have had years to look at this, scratching your head, trying to figure out, like all of us, how did Lead Skolnin do this? Are you changing your thoughts on this?
George, I have to tell you that the information that we're talking about tonight, I had years ago, but it was so bizarre that I have to give credit to Joe McMoneagle, which you've had on the show before. Mm-hmm. If I can just give a little background on him,
sure.
He had an out-of-body experience when he was in the service, where he died for 30 minutes. And in that time, he passed through the tunnel, like a lot of people, saw the light. The voice came and told him, go back. It's not your time. You have work to do. He goes back into the body. Well, George, he was given the gift of remote viewing, which for the listeners out there, it's kind of hard to explain, but it's kind of like astral projection, but it's where you leave the body and you go and see different places. And so he was in the military and did a lot of work for them. Well, after he retired from there, he moved to Virginia, and they wanted to test his skills in remote viewing. So they put him in a room, George. In the next room, they put a cardboard box, taped it down, and put materials in it. Well, they laid him back on a couch, much like an Edgar Cayce regressive hypnosis therapy session. An interviewer asked him to go into the next room, into the box, and find what he saw. He goes into the next room, George, and all of a sudden he describes, hey, I'm in the bottom of like a volcanic crater. And the interviewer told him, said, okay, move up to the top of the crater, look over it, and tell me what you see. He said, it's a rocky crater. I'm walking up it. He's sweating, walking up, looks over the rim, and out in the distance, George, about 100 yards, he says, wow, I see this building, but it's a face, and it looks melted as if though it's been there 1,000,000,000 years. He looks to the right, and he sees a group of buildings that look like flat-top pyramids. And there's a street, George, that is dividing these pyramids. The interviewer is listening to him. He says, okay, move toward the building where the face is. So Joe moves there, stands in front of it, says, I'm here in front of the face. The interviewer says, move in and tell me what you see. At this moment, George, he said his body broke down like in molecules, like in Star Trek when they
right.
beam you in and out.
Okay.
And he said that he could feel his body passing through the stone, much like maybe Jesus walked through walls, this kind of thing. Well, when his body reformed inside this building, which was a face, and it looked like just someone had cut off a face and plopped it in the ground with the eyes staring up. The nose was only like two holes, and it was kind of a slit mouth, very much alien face. As he entered this face, George, his body came together like little tiny lights that were blinking off and on like lightning bugs or icicle lights. As his body was formed, he looked around. There were stone benches, couches, chairs, very much like Ed had done at Coral Castle. And they were filled by humanoid-looking people. Some of them were very tall, 7 feet tall.
Really?
Some yes. Some were very small, 3 and 4 feet. Well, he said these people appeared to be in a coma or in a trance. And he said the tall one, 7 feet tall, looked over, and as soon as the points of light came together and Joe's body formed, the humanoid looked at him and said, are you here to rescue us? And Joe's senses were just kind of coming back, and he looked at the being, and he said something like, I beg your pardon, or could you repeat that? And the being said, are you here to rescue us? We are waiting to be rescued. Now, at this moment, remember Joe had the heart attack. Well, his body started kind of, I don't know if it was so much for him to handle, but the interviewer got scared because there was silence for like 2-3 minutes. And all of a sudden,
he was going to die on him, didn't he?
Yes. The interviewer said, come back, Joe, come back. Get out of there, get out of there. Like he was in danger or something. Well, Joe comes back into his body. The interview, George, Joe said, was white as a sheet. And so Joe asked him, you know, what's wrong? And he said, well, come into the next room and I'll show you. Well, George, they go into the next room. They cut open the cardboard box, open it up, Of course, Joe's curious as to what's going on here. And
sure.
they pull out, George, a picture of the 1976 satellite photo of the Mars face. In front of the Mars face, George, is a huge volcanic crater about 100 yards from the face. On the right, now I had never noticed this until I saw the picture in Joe's book, okay? To the right of the face and the moon crater in front is a complex of pyramid-looking buildings with flat tops with a road going between them.
Right. They call that the city, I think.
Exactly. George, if you look at that, it matches, and I've been there, and I've climbed that pyramid. It's a representative of Chichen Itza.
Just like it.
It's a model of it.
Are you saying that Ed Lead Skolnin had some kind of extraterrestrial help?
Just like Wernher von Braun from Germany, they have proven that in 1936 the Germans captured a downed UFO. Wernher von Braun admitted it. It's been on the History Channel. I'm not making this up. He said when a person asked him, he said, yes, we had help, meaning the alien help. What, George, did you get the picture of Ed that I sent you?
Yeah.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, it should be up on the website right now.
This is what I wanted you to look at, and I so wish, you know, your listeners could see this picture because
yeah,
things started coming to me. Look at his hands, George. They look more like claws. It's not a great picture, but it's the only one I had. But his arms are long. They don't fit his body. His hands don't fit his body. We all know about the star child that was found, the skull that was found in the Texas cave that has the round eyes. George, if you look at the alien face that's at Coral Castle, and the reason I was telling you in the earlier about, don't forget, Ed said, I also understand the secrets of the Peruvians. Well, if you go to Peru, what do you find? You find the Nazca lines. All right. Go look at the alien face, the alien figure that's standing there with his hand waving. The eyes are round with a kind of a slit mouth. If you go to Coral Castle and look at the face that Ed put in what he called the altar stone, it's an exact replica of the Nazca face.
Well, now, but let's assume the ETs helped the Egyptians with
right.
the pyramids.
Right.
If that's the case, and Ed knew that, simply by saying, I know the secrets of the pyramids, could also mean I know that they had gotten ET help like he probably did.
Of course. It's all becoming very clear now. And Joe's book gave me the courage. Ed and I'm not going to release this information yet because I'm not decided yet, but I'm toying with the idea of coming out with a sequel on Waiting for Agnes discussing Ed's experiences in, I think, a Martian time, okay? And I just didn't have the courage to do this when Mr. Bullard was telling me this story because it was so bizarre, George, and you and I are both fanatics on Twilight Zone, Rod Serling,
yeah,
and it sounded
absolutely.
Something just like that. And my book was already 350 pages, and I said, I'm going to leave that out because it's too bizarre. I'll come back to it one day. But I just didn't have the courage. And now seeing his book and seeing now what I think Ed was telling us, what my question is now, you know, well, Ray Stoner said in his book, they were asking him how was this knowledge preserved in Ed? How and why? And he said, there's three ways. Ed was a time traveler, he was an interdimensional being, or he was an extraterrestrial. Now, I'd like to add maybe a fourth one to that. Maybe a humanoid. Maybe
maybe a human who was merely helped.
Exactly. Because, remember, the antenna that he put up over his castle when they came in and thought he was a Russian spy, he had to show them that it was a radio frequency. And remember, George, the last time when you called and interviewed Bruce Cathy in Australia had discovered this same antenna above these government buildings, and he claimed that the Australian government was in contact with UFOs through this, and it matched exactly the antenna that Ed had.
Now, did anybody ever report seeing lights or objects around Coral Castle?
Okay. I interviewed a lady whose father was one of the children who witnessed the blocks being floated like hydrogen balloons. Okay?
All right. That's great.
I had never released this either because, like I said, I was trying to stay away from the alien connection because, you know, a lot of people just thought it was too weird, and I thought I'll stay away from it. He said that one night he and a friend, they would go there, George. They could go there at 3 o'clock in the morning if they were children because, remember, Ed worked from midnight until 6, so he was up. And the kids would grab a bunch of hot dogs, and they'd go by his tower, and they'd say, "Hey, Ed," and what they loved about him was Ed allowed them to call him Ed. They didn't say they couldn't pronounce Lead Scalman.
And that was in an era where everything was Mr., right?
And I was just going to say, he hated the word Mr. They called him Ed. He was a child at heart. So they would grab their hot dogs, George, go up and say, "Ed, we're here. Can we have a hot dog roast?" And he'd stick his head out the window and he'd say, "Sure, boys, come on."
All right, but he didn't want them watching how he moved the blocks, right?
No, no. Only, you know, but he knew, George, by that sixth sense when they were coming. So if they're carrying hot dogs and that stuff, he knows 100 yards that they're coming. So he didn't have to worry about that.
All right, but in terms of anybody seen sightings, what did we see?
Oh, okay. So the boy said, "We came by there one night, and we were going to do the hot dog roast, but we got scared because they saw a triangular shape. It was very dark now. They said all we could see, it was pretty high up. There was three lights on each of the triangles and one in the center." You hear a lot of those things, the ones that have gone over Belgium, Arizona, that kind of stuff. He said, "We saw it," and he said it had hovered there. And he said there was just a humming sound like a
And this was 1920, 23, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And like I said, that was still at the time when Ed had the antennas up there. And the boy said, "We got so scared. We dropped our hot dogs. We did everything. And we just took off." And he said, "And that was the only time that I ever saw something weird." He said, "I've never told anybody about it." And he said, you know, he kind of got to be my friend, and he said, "I'm telling you this." And he said, "I don't know what it was," but he said, "We never saw it again." And he said, you know, every time we went back, we hollered at Ed, you know, louder before we got there because we were afraid of that thing. We didn't know what it was.
Well, hey, by the way, the only picture we have up on the website, two of them, but one is a little kid sitting on some stones, and the other is a cardboard cutout of Lead Scalman.
Yes, that's down at Coral Castle. The cardboard cutout is actually in the room there.
Okay, so I don't have the one with the claw look.
Oh, you didn't get? Oh, my God. I'm so sorry. I sent it to Lex.
Send it again. Hey, I think he can still probably get it up there.
Okay. All right. But
and do it during the break or something at the top of the hour.
That, George, I don't have my computer the way it sits. I doubt that I can get it through in that time. I'm having computer problems. So,
are you? Okay.
Yeah, but in the picture, if you can just imagine this, you know how the ET hands usually show three fingers and they're like string beans?
Yeah, yeah.
That's exactly what his hands look like, except maybe more misshapen and more alien-looking. And his arms, it shows him standing there, and his arms are almost past his knees.
Is he a shapeshifter?
It makes you wonder, yes.
I'm sure if he only had three fingers, people would have said that earlier, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, he had all his fingers, but they were curved, more like bear claws and long.
Like hooks.
Yeah. Like hooks, exactly. Yeah.
Huh.
So just, you know, and the more I look at it, the more I think, you know, how many people have had the sixth sense that, you know, you couldn't sneak up on them? He cures himself of tuberculosis. You know, he says, "I understand the secrets of the pyramids," all these kind of things. George, there's never been a human being like Ed. And, you know, George, I heard a person talking the other day who's way up, and I don't want to mention any names, but who studies the same things we're doing and almost the grandfather of this. And his associate asked him, he was a friend of mine, and he asked him about Coral Castle. And he said, "Why don't you study Coral Castle? Why?" And he said, "Well, Coral Castle is not old enough." And, you know, basically he just said it's not worth our time to study it. And yet, George, many, and I'm totally in agreeing with this, the experts, we all agree that aliens either did this or helped it. Okay, well, if that's the truth, all right, if the aliens built Stonehenge, the pyramids, if this is so, did an alien or a star being build Coral Castle?
Maybe so. So you're saying possibly they gave him the knowledge of how to do this and then he went off and did it on his own?
Yes. Yes.
So if that's the case, did he leave any symbols around there? I know he had like a face there and on an altar stone. What else did he do there?
George, I believe, and if you remember the story I told you about the burlap bag that was up in his quarters that someone came in and stole, I believe, George, that Ed, that sounds just like Ed. He would have sewn, I believe that he left, you know, a lot of the crashed ships leave the hieroglyphics behind, and, you know, they always say we can't understand what they look like and everything. I believe, according to Mr. Bullard, he believes that, and Ed would have done it on a burlap sack because people wouldn't have paid any attention to it. We might have thrown it away if we were cleaning out Coral Castle. I believe that he left behind a map. Now, there are stories that when the thieves broke in, there was a map there. And in fact, they overlooked it, and the police actually found it. And the map that Ed left behind was not leading to a treasure, and they tried to follow it, and they said it did not match. There was numbers and all that kind of stuff. It did not match any numbers and any mathematics that we can understand.
He was in the numbers, wasn't he?
Oh, George, everything was math, just like Stonehenge. George, I really believe that, okay, Coral Castle, from what my studies and what I can see is, I think it's a Polaris star-aligned astronomical observatory. He took 1,100 tons of eulitic limestone, put in a sundial, a moondial. George, is the only moondial in the world. 25 one-ton rocking chairs, a 9-ton swinging gate in the middle of the Florida Everglades at the tip of the Bermuda Triangle.
That's
now,
interesting.
Kathy, yes, said there's a vast power grid between some groups on the Earth. And Kathy said these lines of flight show verified UFO appearances. Now, this is Kathy. Coral Castle was possibly a meeting place with 25 chairs and a Florida table. For one day, maybe instead of United Nations, it'll be United People and Aliens meeting.
And how do we know Agnes wasn't one?
It could be. It really could be. And, you know, there's a lot of debate. People say, well, I don't think she existed. Well, if you could hear Mr. Bullard describe his obsession and his passion for her in his voice, he said Agnes existed. Ed never got over her. And, you know, the strange thing, George, Agnes, or when Ed moved the castle from Florida City to Homestead, Mr. Bullard told me he was talking to Ed one day, and he said, Ed, I noticed in the tours anymore you don't mention the love story in Agnes so much. What happened? Why? What happened to Agnes? And he said, Ed kind of gave him a grin, and he said, oh, JT, that was the name, JT Bullard. He said, oh, JT, he said, I left her back in Florida City.
Huh.
This meant, George, because a lot of people say, well, you know, he wasn't stupid. Surely he had to know she wasn't coming. Of course he knew he wasn't coming. But everybody loved the story, but it was Ed's way of telling Mr. Bullard that he had moved on in his heart.
Right. Right. And he never married. He never did anything like that, did he?
No, but he was a great flirt. I talked to a lady down there who said, now, Ed was a little guy, but when he took
charming,
his shirt.
Charming, right?
Very charming. Just wonderful. Oh, never cursed, they heard him say. Loved children and had a great sense of humor. You know, they'd ask him how he moved a 30-ton stone, and he'd point to an old wheelbarrow that was falling apart, and he'd say, oh, well, that wheelbarrow there. Of course, everybody would laugh, you know. And But this lady said when Ed took his shirt off, which he didn't do too much, only around the people he knew because he was a little shy guy,
she
said he was built like just very muscular and wiry and, you know, sexy in his own way. And she said, we flirted around a lot, but Ed told me, he said, I can never be serious about anybody because my Agnes is coming here to marry me.
And he waited and waited and waited. We're going to take phone calls with you next, Joe, on Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome back, Moors. There you have it. That's very, very interesting what's going on down here in the state of Florida at Coral Castle. Ed Lee Scallion is the one who built this castle, built it in Florida City, and then moved it stone by stone down the street, less than 10 miles away, approximately 10 miles away, and re-put it together and kept everybody from seeing how he did it. Amazing. And well, what I'm looking at here is the magnetic alteration that will cause metal to iron to float on water and stones to float, because I have tried and tried and tried and tried to figure out how was it humanly possible for them to build the great pyramids of Kemet and the quarries where they had to take the stones from was miles and miles and miles away. There was no quarries. So in my opinion, then we got the Nile could have said that it was possible for them to move the stones down the Nile. But getting up to the pyramids, we have what's called cataracts. Now, what those are is imagine a river being free-flowing and all of a sudden, right smack dab across the river, you got this big giant bank that just comes right across the river so that no water is flowing across it. The water of any kind of way is going underneath. So how you go bring these stones down the river on the boat. First of all, how you going to get them on a craft to bring them down there in the first place? Then if you manage to do that, what are you going to do when you get to the first cataract? We had several cataracts leading up to where these stones were put in place. Then we have the other mystery. Even if we manage to get past all of that, how are we going to stack these stones side by side with such precision as if they were cut with a laser? This is quite amazing. Now, at this point, before we go on with some more of this right here, if there's anybody out here in this radio audience listening, if you can help me out with this mystery, go ahead and raise your hand. I'll listen to what you got to say. The number to call into this broadcast is 310-982-4184. What's on your mind? Go ahead and raise your hand. I'll open up the line so that you can get in. Our guests will be coming in shortly, but in the meantime, we have a few minutes where we can discuss this thing, because this is quite amazing. I have done quite a bit of research on the works of Edgar Cayce, all your major psychics. I've investigated the building of the Great Pyramids and have remained baffled for years and years and years until here recently that I think that I may be peering through some light. Okay, just barely now, just barely. Area code 352.
Assalamu alaikum, Islam. Regarding the technology to lift up them stones, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said a laser. And I know if you look at some of the ancient writings of the building of King Solomon's temple, they say that they a similar process when they cut those stones. And then I think it's in the Talmud. It's called the Shamir. They use the Shamir to cut the stones, and Shamir comes from the root of Sham, which be like the sun, which light comes from, and Ir, which could also come from that abode of light. So it could be like, it would point to a laser as far as cutting the stones. Now, when you're speaking about how they levitated them stones, I think you have to go into what they call the science of the ether. and how they were able to use the ether and pull it into a device to lift it up. And that deals with the science of the pyramid. If you look at the pyramid, we're dealing with a trilateral. And if you go with electricity or electric field, and you got a magnetic field, then they got what's called electromagnetic field, but you also have gravity. And there's been experiments where electricity could take away the effects of gravity with electricity. And this is simple. If anyone has some basic tools, battery, some wires, and a light switch, and you connect it to a piece of metal, say like a little piece of stainless steel, and if you don't press on that light switch and press it on initially, just initially, that little connection when you first press it and you put it on, it gives a shock, and it'll lift up off the ground. So that same shock right there, if you were to make it pulsate at, I'd say, thousands or millions times per second, you'd be able to get some levitation off the ground of a piece of metal. So these ancient Moors, they had to configure something that would get underneath them stones once they quarried them and lift it up out of there using a similar type of technology. And if you went down to Cole Castle, you would see that he had some devices, which they say is a sundial or moondial, which in fact looks more like an electrical generator.
Okay, well now, we have to look at the facts that inside the United States, all over the United States, we got pyramids, we got walls and stuff built. Now, my next question to you is, in your opinion, where did we get this technology from?
I would say this technology's always been with us. I mean, we came upon it on our own through our ancient ancestors and those catastrophes. There was like about four world catastrophes that I recorded. And what happened was during world catastrophes, most of the population was wiped out, and the few that remained, they had to reinvent what was already done. So, example, let's say right now, if there was a major worldwide cataclysm, we know about using the internet, computers, and all that. But a lot of us don't know how to make a computer, how to get the manufacturing facilities, microchips to do all that. We don't have that at our disposal. We could speak about it, but we don't have it at our disposal. So I would proffer that during those catastrophes, it was just pieced back together. Now, if you want to go through the ancient aliens, it would still go back to us, back to being Moors. If we came from another planet and we came on this planet, it was our ancestors, and we developed, you know, through human evolution.
Okay. Now, in this plug that I read, they seem to want to attribute this to some alien intervention. So in your opinion, we know that our ancestors go back hundreds of thousands of years. Think it is possible that we had some type of contact with them, not to say that we got it from them, but do you think they maybe have played some type of insignificant or significant part in the construction of the Great Pyramid? Okay, the brother call is dropped. If there's anybody else who got a question to comment, go ahead and raise your hand. I will open up the line and let you in, okay?
Hi, I'm Tahaka Amana El Bay. There's some very important things that we need to consider when dealing with police stops. First of all, does failure to wear a seatbelt constitute a breach of the peace? Is it a public nuisance? Is there an injured party? If a policeman stops you, is he an officer of the law? Has he taken a public oath of office? Is he a public official? Criminal impersonation in the first degree is a felony. In order to exercise your freedom of rights successfully, contact me, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, area code 904-303-9061, before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Send an email to Tahaka53@hotmail.com.
All right, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Joe Bullard as we talk about Edward Lead Skolnin and Coral Castle. If you've been to Coral Castle, please check in with us as well when we come right back to take calls on Coast to Coast AM. Ed, apparently, Joe, Ed had cryptoamnesia. What the heck is that?
Okay. This is a condition, George, where if someone has a traumatic experience, it could be the death of a child, the loss of any loved one. You know, George, a lot of people commit suicide over lost loves and anything that's destructive or traumatic. Now, in Ed's case, he grows up, he's 26, he's never really dated. When he falls in love with Agnes, that's the only girl for him.
Yeah, well, he's gone. Gone over the edge on that one.
Yeah, and he just, they said he walked around for a couple of days, just a daze, in a funk, and that's when he jumped on the boat and went to Canada. He had to get out of there. He said, I can't walk the streets, go to the restaurants. Well, he was affected by this in a way. What happened, George, he retreated into his books. Remember, as a child, he studied. Even as a child, his grandfather would rock him. And that's another thing. Why do you say 25 run-ton, one-ton rocking chairs? Because as a child, his grandfather rocked him in the chairs, read Egyptian stories to him, mathematics, all types of magnetic books and all his adventures. His grandfather was a seaman and told him all these places he'd been, how he'd seen, you know, the Mayans and this kind of thing. Well, Ed grew up with books, so when he got hurt or in trouble as he was a child, he went to his books. So when Agnes jilted him, he went to his books. Now, the condition of cryptoamnesia, what it states is a person who's had this traumatic experience and has, let's say, a person reads a lot of books on the Civil War. Now, if that person has a traumatic experience, George, and you take him under aggressive hypnosis and all of a sudden he starts telling you about the Battle of Gettysburg and he says, yes, I was there, the bombs went off. What he's doing, George, is he's describing under hypnosis what he's read in those books, because the mind, the way it works, it tries to make us happy and it tries to give us what we need to fill that void that the traumatic experience happened. So when that person comes out of hypnosis, you might say, well, gosh, he's done all these things in these past lives. Now, I'm not knocking past lives. Everybody's different. The psychiatrist who interviewed Ed said, you know, he perfectly believes what he's saying. If he tells you he saw a UFO crash in the Chaco Canyon a million years ago when he was an Indian boy, that very well could be. But in this case, it could be that he read that in a book and he's reciting that. So cryptoamnesia is basically something that just tells us that that person has read these things in a book and he's given us that back in his mind and he's telling us that. But actually he read it in a book and is just reciting what he read.
Do we know if Ed ever visited the pyramids at Giza?
In his visions and dreams.
But not physically?
Not physically, no. Huh. No. I actually, in the book, you know, I have him go there because it's the vision and the dream that he described. Had he been there, this is what would have happened. So in the book, I take some liberties with it. I actually have him go there because the way he describes it, I mean, he had to have been there. If he didn't go there in his body, he went there like the remote viewing, like Joe McMoneagle. See, as a child, Ed's mother was, when she was pregnant with Ed, she leaned up against a fence and her, she was in trouble. She was almost ready to deliver. She sees Madame Drusa, who's a psychic's place. Well, the boy spoke to her and said, go in and see about the child, meaning the coming of Ed. Well, she goes in. Long story short, the psychic tells Ed, or the lady, his mother, Karina, as she's laying on the couch, the child will be born a month early, be premature, never have any patience, can't wait for anything, can't wait to get in the world, can't wait to get out of it, that kind of thing. And he will reveal to the world secrets that have not been known since the time of the pyramids. He will reveal the secrets of them.
You say there was a, you say there was a stone too of unknown origin that was
yes.
there. What was that?
Okay, the stone of unknown origin exists under the 9-ton swinging gate. Now, here's another wild thing. Okay, Ed originally, instead of calling it Coral Castle, it was called, he called it Rock Gate. Now, think about it, George. We all hear about stargates, which are portals to pass in and out of time, right?
Right, right.
Okay, so if you spin the 9-ton gate, you're inside the castle. If you step outside, at the Coral Castle down there, there's nothing but open space. So what Ed was saying was, this is the way, this is the stargate, but he called it Rock Gate, to step through time, okay? Like, of many dimensions of time and space. So when the 9-ton gate stopped working in 1986, the wheel bearings broke underneath it. You could press it with a finger. I was there in 84 before it broke, okay? In 86, it breaks. Well, they call the University of Florida, and they say, look, here's our problem, this swinging gate. Of course, Florida didn't know anything about it, but they had all these guys with PhDs, and they said, hey, if it's broken, we can fix it. We got the best engineers in the world. Well, the maintenance man told me, these great professors came down there, looked at it, and what happened, George, was the right end of the stone, wheel bearings broke, and the stone tilted. Well, they said to find the center of gravity, and remember, the 9-ton stone is 3 feet wide. It's 9 feet tall, okay?
It's huge.
It's huge. I mean, you know, so there's no way that they could lift it. Well, the engineer said that it would take laser technology today to find the secret of the center of the gravity of the stone, because what it did was he found the gravity of the stone. It would be like trying to balance a spoon on the edge of a table. You have to find that gravity before you can drill the hole. Well, he had no electricity. How did he drill a hole all the way through the stone? He runs a rod down to it, connecting the wheel bearings, so the stone actually sits on the wheel bearings. But underneath the wheel bearings is this weird stone, about the size of a car tire, but only about 4 inches thick. So it almost looked like a UFO, if you would. But it has a weird, quartzy, grainy-looking material in the middle of it, George. Well, what happens is the scientists from Florida leave. They throw up their hands and they say, you know, this is just a bunch of rocks, and if we had time, we could figure it out. They were very angry. Well, they had to hire a construction crew. They came in with 2 80-ton cranes, wrapped chains around this 9-ton stone, lifted it up. They found the origin, the unknown origin stone. Well, it had broken the way they lifted it. Well, the pieces were lost, but one guy grabbed a piece of it because they were just going to throw it away. He said, no, there's something weird. How could it support 9 tons? He sends it to the geology department at the University of Florida. Now, here again, people don't want to talk about weird things or UFOs or aliens because their job could be in trouble. You know, you start talking that stuff, you get fired. Well, the geologists at the University of Florida were scared to say what it was, but they said they could not find the origin. The makeup of the stone could not be found on the earth, so they marked it origin unknown.
I love that. I would have loved to have met him. How about you?
Oh, George, imagine Ed and Tesla together. See, Tesla had the same ideas. He talked to, even, in fact, I was researching today, Tesla even said he believed in aliens and UFOs. He said, anybody's crazy to believe in this galaxy and this universe, that we're the only people. Tesla made that statement.
Good point. Good point. All right, let's go take some calls here for you. They're lining up. We'll go to Nate in Ida, Michigan, first of all. Nate, go ahead.
Hi, it's good to be on the air.
Good. Glad you're with us.
All right. My question is if there is any evidence as to the type of alien that could have possibly been used, maybe a drawing or something like that, whether it be the reptilians or the Nordic Greys, maybe, or, you know, is there any evidence leading to what sort of alien it could be, if it was even aliens?
No, I would have no information on that. There are, if you get a copy of Joe McMonald's book, there is a drawing, of the 7-foot-tall alien and the smaller alien, and you really can't tell anything. They look more like jarheads. Their eyes are not as big as the regular grays that we think of. They're smaller. They are teardropped, and they do look humanoid. They have a human body, but more square-headed. But there's no way we could tell. You know, that's an interesting question, though, Nate, because In Nancy Red Star's book, she actually mentions that our military, she was able to get this information, that in the 1947 time after Roswell, the military believed that there was only 12 extraterrestrial races. As time went on in the 50s and 60s, that increased to 75 races. Now, she said they believe there's over 100 varieties of alien races.
I could believe that.
Yeah. Why not?
Next up, we go to Kevin in St. Paul, Minnesota. Kevin, you're up with us. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just wanted to talk about how the Hutchinson effect had kind of can relate to how they levitated the stones in the Coral Castle to construct the building. I was just wondering if there's anything tangible with that relating to maybe possibly how they could have levitated it besides just the forces that they were talking about through the frequencies of sound.
A lot of similarities. I don't know if you know about the Hutchinson effect at all, Joe, but...
You're the expert on that, George. I'll let you know.
It deals with electromagnetics and everything else, which I think Ed was probably pretty close to, don't you?
Oh, that's everything he talked about, electromagnetics. I mean, he said that's gravity. That's what we're made of. It's gravity.
Wasn't there a device that looked like it was cannibalized? It looked like a flywheel or something?
That is the perpetual motion holder, George. And it was cannibalized, yes. But a couple of years ago, a couple of guys got down there, hooked it up, cranked it up, and it ran light bulbs with no electricity.
And it kind of goes in a circle, right?
It's right. Imagine a washing machine with an old handle on it, and, George, there's about, oh, gosh, maybe 100 U-shaped magnets that are all wrapped in copper, size of a wash tub, and the actual machine is inside. The wash tub is like an iron ring, if you will. The magnets are inside, and when you crank the handle, those magnets start spinning. And what they do is the positive and the negative magnetic charge, they chase each other just like the North and South Pole magnets. And until you break that circuit, George, the reason that this system works, that physicists say it won't work, is because it's like a dog chasing his tail. If you don't stop him, he'll chase it forever.
Well, he sure will. Absolutely. Somebody owns Coral Castle now, right? They bought it from the original owner who had bought it after Lead Skaldin died?
Ed left it to his nephew. His nephew was not in good health. He kept it a couple of years. He sold it to another person. And then I believe in the 1980s, another couple that own it today from Chicago actually bought it and own it today.
And it's like a little tourist spot down there. And it's a protected site now too, isn't it?
Building? Yeah, no. Well, it's historic, but, I mean, it's not really protected. It's privately owned. It has nothing to do with the state or the federal government, but it is on the historical register.
Could it be dismantled if somebody wanted to?
The whole place?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, they could.
I don't know how they would do it, though, if they can't lift a 10-ton stone. They'd have to knock them down and drag them.
Joe, when you're there, do you feel anything special, any powers?
George... Oh, my God, that's a great question. There's actually spots down there, and I was taken to these spots. I would not have believed this. You stand in certain spots, George. You stick your arm out. A person can pull down on your arm, and you're so strong that they cannot pull your arm down. That person can take you to another spot, say 10 feet away. You stick your arm out, and you have no strength.
Huh.
It is a total baffling experience. That energy line that ran through there, I don't believe, a lot of the experts will tell you that it's not as powerful as it used to be, but remember that spinning triangular stone that I told you about last time? It has two holes cut in it like mouse holes. When you spin that and go 50 yards away and, you know, turn your back to it and hold these rods out, it makes the rods move as if there were water. And you said yourself, and this was beautiful, the way you said it, you said, well, it's an energy accumulator. And somehow, George, when you spin that triangular stone at the entrance of Coral Castle, somehow it sends a wave motion down there, an electronic or magnetic wave motion, and you can have two, you know, like when they're dowsing for water and they have two L-shaped, L-shaped metal rods. Well, those metal rods will close and form an X from that spinning stone, and I saw it happen.
Is there any specific spot there that you feel more energized?
Yes. Yes, and this is weird, But when you go to the chair on his throne room up there, and he used to tell, and it works for adults too, but he loved children. So when he would get children there, and some of them would be sick or have this and that, he would take them to this special chair, and he would say, honey, sit in this chair, and you just stay in here for 15 or 20 minutes, and you will never be sick again. I actually interviewed a woman who did that and who grew up, and she said, I'm 82 years old today, and I've never had health problems. And I believe, George, that there was a special area there where he knew that that current, that esoteric energy was strong, and he placed that chair in that spot.
Let's go to Cindy in South Carolina, first-time caller. Cindy, go ahead.
Hi, y'all. I'm calling to talk about a situation that I had back in 2010. I was in Key West, Florida, and I heard Coast to Coast talking about Coral Castle. I had never heard about it before. So I decided on the way up to a business trip to Miami, I decided to stop in. So I got in there about 1:30 in the afternoon, and I took the regular little tour they had, and it was all about Agnes. But I kept asking questions, different questions, and the girl was kind of raising her eyebrow up at me. And so about 4 o'clock, a man came up to me. He was one of the tour guides, and he started talking to me, and we started talking about more about energy. I am an energy practitioner by trade. Started talking, and it went to 5 o'clock, and it was about time for it to close. And he said, you want to stay a little late? And he was really agitated but excited. He said, I want to show you something. I got to show you something. And so he took me to the north wall, and he said, look, do you see those numbers? And I kind of looked for a minute, and I couldn't see them. He said, look again. And then I saw the numbers. There were some numbers in the wall. I wish to goodness I'd taken a picture or written them down. But he said, they're coming tonight. And he said, they're coming about 7. Well, at that point, I knew, I'm not asking who's coming, but I just kind of listened. And he said, they have finally showed up. They've finally showed up. He was very excited. Like I said, it was on the north wall. We had already walked all over the place. I told him, I said, you know, I'm not a dummy here. This is pretty much set up like a Masonic lodge. And he laughed. And, you know, I jump up on a piece of furniture, and I say, I think this is this. And he'd laugh and laugh. And we even looked at the steps going down in the well. He said, what do you see? I said, 11 steps. He said, do you know what 11 is? I said, yes, I do. I said, that's master number. He said, yes. This man said that he was a retired Department of Defense fellow that came down there. He said he worked there for his health. Then he says, come on over to the chair. And it wasn't the chair you're talking about, like the one that sits up at in the middle where you
right,
think
that's
of.
That's the big one.
But, yeah, not the big one. There were two chairs. And one was on the right, one was on the left. He said, if you sit on this one on the right, whatever you've got in your body that doesn't need to be in there will come out. And then he said, and you sit over on the left, whatever's inside your body, whatever you need will be put back in. I said, whatever, I'll go up there. And so he said, hop up here. There's nobody but me and him in this place. I'm sitting in the chair. He even takes my camera and took a picture of me. And I'm sitting there, and I can feel a buzzing, like, you know, that energy.
Was it going through your body?
Uh-huh. Kind of like, you know, felt good. You know, just kind of feel it.
There's a lot of power there. Hey, we got to take this quick break. But quick story, shooting at a Catholic church in Phoenix, one priest dead, another in critical condition. Back in a moment. On our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to talk about the future you never saw coming. And then Nick Pope joins us with some incredible UFO stories. That'll be our next Coast to Coast show. Back with Joe Buller. Joe, did Ed Leeds Skolnin live at Coral Castle?
Yes. Yes, George. He actually had a little shack there that he lived in until the castle was completed. You know, he had to put up the walls and everything. But, yes, he lived in there. Totally, and only went out every now and then. He would drive down to Mr. Bullard's gas station, and he would pick up sardines, saltine crackers and milk and pickled eggs. That was his favorite foods, and he'd ride around on his bicycle. He loved to go to the movies. He loved the silent films the best, and a lot of times the kids would meet him there, and then after that, the show was over, they'd go back to Coral Castle for a Rini roast. So, yeah, he totally lived in there all his life.
And, I mean, did it have running water, bathrooms, things like that?
Nothing, no. He had a little shack out there that was kind of like an outhouse, and that was his bathroom facilities. There was no running water. He had the well there that the lady was describing, and you actually walked down about 11 steps, and there was fresh water there at the time. It's kind of polluted now, but he got all his drinking water, and he could lower a bucket if he didn't want to walk down there. He lowered the bucket, and you remember his bathtub was set so that when the sun rose at 9 in the morning, it warmed up his bathtub. It faced on the west wall there. The sun rose in the east, so the water was struck by the sun. So at 4 o'clock, he said a man should only work from 9 to 4, so he would hop in his bathtub at 4 o'clock when the water was warm, and that's how he took a bath.
He had a telescope there, didn't he?
George, that's a great question. His telescope was in two pieces. It was about one. The long piece was about 25 feet tall. It had a coffee cup hole cut in it with wires like a gun telescopic sight. And the front sight was a pyramid-shaped stone with a hole cut in it and wires and matching. At night, you could look through this telescope, and the North Star fell in the crosshairs and the pieces of the telescope at night.
I bet that would have been amazing to see.
George, here's what's so wild. This is how intelligent he was, and we forget about this, but the Earth actually wobbles. The reason that he put the crosshairs in there, the North Star didn't just fall at the intersection of the wires because of the Earth's wobble, like a top when it's starting to fall over, it wobbles. So the North Star will fall in each section of the pie until it makes the complete circle inside the telescopic sights.
Back to the phones we go. Let's go first to Lynn in Bradford, Maine. Hey, Lynn, go ahead.
Listen, that book, who wrote, what was this guy's, how do you spell his last name?
Leed Skolnin?
Yeah.
That guy?
Yeah.
L-L-E-E-D-S-K-A-L-N-I-N.
Okay. What happened when I was younger, I found a rock. Okay, it looked like a piece of lava found on the beach, and it floated in the salt water, sunk in the water, you know, fresh water. I didn't think much about it. I threw it in a drawer, and I took it out one day, and it was covered with magnets.
Wow.
And, you know, it's like my family's like, oh, you're nuts, you know. But it just, everything that was magnetic would draw to it, and I put it near a compass, and the compass went haywire. And this Coral Castle, I am fascinated. This is the most interesting thing I have ever heard.
Oh, it really is.
I would love to go down there. That's where I'm going for my next vacation.
Yeah. What's it cost to go down there and tour the place?
It's $10 for each
That's
person.
That's it? That's not bad. And you know, the structure itself, how big is it?
It's about a quarter of a size of a football field, or a third.
Well, see, he had some nice property down there.
Yeah, he had 10 acres originally. There's now about 4 acres that it sits on, and that's what I'm saying. The castle sits real close to the road, and then the back part there is just an open field. And, you know, sadly, that's where he wanted to be buried. And he didn't get that chance. One of my dreams is to take him out of Miami and put him back in Homestead one day.
Do we know much about his family in Latvia?
George, I have had people go over there. The weird thing is they only know that he has one cousin there who's about probably 90 years old if he's still alive. They cannot find his original house. There's almost no representation, no proof of his existence.
Nothing.
Nothing. No, all the papers are gone from his family.
Let's go to Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota. Tom, welcome to the program.
Wow, thanks a lot for having me on, George. This is awesome. I've been listening for a long time.
Thank you.
Since the Art Bell days, I'm listening on AM 1500 or AM 1130 here, but I've been listening since the KSTP days here. My dad was a truck driver, but so whenever he was home, he'd have Dreamland on or Art Bell, and so I remember listening I was a really little kid. But thank you. And I also like to give my respects to Ian Punnett. I'm a huge fan of him, and I miss hearing him on the radio.
Okay. Thank you.
I was just thinking, people like Leonardo da Vinci or Christ or Edward Casey or Tesla, like these guys all contributed. They gave something to humanity. Like they had a gift and they gave it to humanity. They contributed. And there's kind of like the author or Mr. Bullard keeps talking a lot about like the myth or the legend, like all the life of Lead Scalin. And I can't help but kind of like resent Lead Scalin a little bit. Like it seems like he's kind of like waving the carrot in front of mankind, proverbially to speak. I mean, like he's all the genius that he is. Like it's like we're figuring it out after he lived his life and died. But he was living in modern times. Like he could have got this kind of technology. Like it could have changed the whole later half of the last century. I just wonder, like, is the site is definitely worth being studied and for its physical phenomenon and having hard science applied to it, but is the man really worth, like, is it really worth our time or our interest or investigation to know who he was if he kind of withheld this from us? I mean, George, I kind of want your answer on this, too, because you are the captain after all.
Well, let me tell you, Tom, I think, and I'll let you listen on the radio, I think it's worth the time to find out who this individual was, how he ticked, the things he knew. If we can find that out, I think he may possess one of the greatest mysteries of this planet, and it's up there in his head. Joe, whether he had ET help or not, the guy was aware of incredible technology that is missing.
George, I can answer that real quickly. He left it for us. He gave it to us. It's at Carl Castle. He left the plans of the whole essence of his being. We're just not taking advantage of it. He left it for us. It's there. If I was a scientist, I'd be on that thing tomorrow. I'm not. I'm a journalist. But to answer the man's question, Ed, when he was beaten up by those what we think were government agents, it scared him. He was afraid to talk about it. So when he died, he left us the plans to build the greatest machine. And it's not being done, George.
He died in 1951.
Yeah. And the weird thing is, he told Mr. Bullard before he was dying, he was December the 7th, and he said, I won't make it into the year 52. And Mr. Bullard said, what do you mean? He said, I need to leave in 51. He said, it's just pertinent that I leave in 51.
Did he get any media coverage or newspaper write-ups in those days?
Oh, yes. Right after he started it, the Homestead Enterprise, which was the local newspaper, went out and interviewed him. He became a celebrity after that. People passed it to their friends, and he was one of the most beloved people. When you read the stuff about him, the gentleman saying, "Is he worth studying?" You know, I could spend 40 hours telling you what a wonderful human being he was. You know, don't judge him because he didn't leave the secrets. He left them, George. But what he was saying to us is, come down here and study what I did, and you'll learn from studying it. It's like, you know, if you fill a trough up with corn and just bring the hogs in, they'll never root. He wanted us to root a little bit, use our minds.
Wiki says that he used reverse magnetism or supernatural abilities to move the stones.
Yes. He basically told us it's all about the magnetic power.
He even wrote a little book about magnets, didn't he?
Oh, yes. Yes, that's the pamphlet that he left behind describing how to make his machine. He gave it away. He couldn't get the patent, so he said, okay, someone out there who understands my technology can come along and build this. And, George, here's what he said. This is how important this is. He said, now, rockets were just coming in when he died in 51. Here's what he said to all the engineers and scientists. He said, come down here and look at my machine. You can put it in the tip of your rocket, fly to Pluto for breakfast, go all over the galaxy, come back to the Earth, have dinner at night, and that machine will have as much energy as when you left.
That's amazing.
He wanted it in homes, cars. See, he and Tesla had the idea. They were going to give away the energy. But, of course, you know, Westinghouse and Edison and all those guys said, heck no, we're going to charge you. Ed thought it was the greatest tragedy in the world that he said, how can you tax the sun?
Why didn't he ever go public with that kind of energy source?
Well, he, like I say, he tried, you know, and then when he was beaten up, George, it was kind of like he retreated back.
It scared him, didn't it?
Oh, God, he was almost dead, and these guys were threatening him. Then the government comes in because they call him a Russian spy. So he's experiencing rejection all over again, and he just couldn't handle it.
Huntsville, Alabama, we go. It's Daniel's turn on Coast to Coast. Daniel, good morning.
Hey there. This is Daniel. I am currently in Huntsville, Alabama, but I was born and raised in Miami, Florida.
Okay.
And as a kid, I used to go there. You know, I went there first with my grandmother by bus, you know, and I was drawn to that place over and over and over again. And once I had a bicycle, I used to ride there all the time. On that north wall, which that previous guest or lady spoke of, I had found there was all kinds of weird wires with old insulators, like ceramic insulators along that wall. And on the inside, above the door, years ago, I'm 52 now, which is, well, not that old, but kind of getting there. But there used to be some part or apparatus of perhaps this machine of which this gentleman speaks of. And there were just all kinds of really neat things. Also in there, Hurricane Andrew really messed it up. The wind, you know, caught way over 200 miles an hour. Is that
enough to knock those blocks over?
No.
Well, some of those walls, those rocks were vertical. And the 200 mile an hour wind on a vertical, you know, coral is a light rock. Coral is all underneath everywhere of South Florida.
Yeah, it sure is.
You dig down 6 feet, it's there. Anyhow, the multi-ton door of which he speaks, that got kind of askew a little bit. And I remember as a kid, I used to just, you could literally touch it with your finger and it would pivot. The door that I remember pivoted dead center. You know, it was like a rotating door. And
did you think, Daniel, that it had any supernatural powers or anything like that?
Well, you know, yeah, the place was set up in that all around the whole facility was built. There was all kind of, remember, there's half moon designs, and there was many things that were set up for if you stood in a certain. It was made so that if you stood in a certain place, you could see certain at night. You could see certain stars at certain times of the year, and you could align yourself with all sorts of things. But also the other thing I remember. See, I just took notes here. See, Coral Castle. I mean, now it's, you know, would be considered very far inland. It's not near the Everglades, and you know, in its time, it would be near the swamp, as would say all of Florida. Was, or still, some of it still is.
Well, let me ask you, Joe, is it protected at this point?
Protected in what way, George?
From people, you know, ransacking it again?
Yes. They have, I'm not sure if it's a 24-hour guard, but they have a fence there, everything. I mean, they lock everything up. Yeah, there's, you know, and George, really, if anybody breaks in, they'd probably just break into the museum there where the stuff is and, you know, but there's really no chance of that because there's so many houses and everything around there. So yeah, it's I mean, it's not police protected, but it's secured.
Have the new owners?
Area code 412. Tell me who you are, where you calling from, what your questions or comments.
Hi, Brother Tahargus, Lisa. I just had a question. He talked about the brother Ed leaving a pamphlet of instructions. So is that pamphlet still available, or do they allow people to purchase anything about that to read? Do you know?
No.
I'm sure they
what
don't.
You have to, What you would have to do is you would have to come down to Core Castle. And,
okay.
What he is saying is for those who have been searching for this kind of knowledge and have been involved in trying to know this type of technology, he left clues throughout the entire area, all of the carved in the walls and everything else. And it's not hard to understand. I think one of the reasons that physicists and scientists can't figure it out is because of the simplicity of it, and they've been educated, well, miseducated away from it.
Right.
Because he's talking about simple magnetic energy.
And I'm trying to think about go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm listening to you.
Oh, no, I kind of think about it from our ancestors' perspective when I was reading the Metu Netter and how it describes our ancestors being able to gather information and technology from a spiritual foundation. It wasn't a physical, and that's why they were able to create so many wonderful monuments and things of that nature. And when you talk about modern day, everything is from the physical as opposed to the spiritual, and spiritual is somewhat suppressed. And I'm not talking spirituality in the church or anything like that. I'm talking about the spiritual connection to the universe. Because they're doing it backwards, like you just said, they can't figure it out.
Because they're trying to do it in the physical realm, and
right.
the type of technology that they are using is far beyond the physical realm. Hold on one second, Lisa. Hold on.
Okay.
Area code 313.
Hey, this is Michael M. Hotep. How you doing, Tahaka?
Welcome, my brother. Welcome. We've been waiting on you to come in, and thank you for joining us here.
Just
hold on one second.
Okay.
I know you're a very busy man. I know you are, brother. Hold on one second. I got a question to ask this sister because I spoke to her earlier today, and she gave me some good news. Lisa.
Okay.
Yes.
What happened with that house? Let us have it.
Oh, the house, the one that they put new locks on and without permission and all that good stuff? When I found out, they did that, I called the police, long story short, filed some papers. And come to find out, the house bill, the mortgage was discharged. And I had sent in affidavits and different things to the mortgage company, and they didn't respond. And when I had my friend look into it, and then I looked into it, the note for the mortgage was discharged. There is a zero balance on the property. And today, after I talked to you, someone offered me $34,000 for an empty shell of a house.
Well, now wait a minute, because see, we got a whole lot of stuff on our plate that we're going to deal with. We got all kind of people to sue. So what you going to do now?
I'm going to sue first and sell later.
All right, so
that's what I'm going to do.
Okay, we're going to talk about this some more, but I just wanted you to come on and give that little testimony. You had gotten the get rid of the mortgage package, and we've been rocking and rolling with this thing. And boy, look here, you I don't know what they're gonna do with you. The lawyer running, the mortgage company running, everybody. Okay, well, my guest has arrived, so hold on.
Okay.
We're gonna get down into the broadcast because he's a very head brother. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right, sister. Michael.
Yes, I'm here, brother. How you doing?
Hey, I'm fine, brother. We've already read your stats and stuff, man. But what I'm curious to know is
All right.
because I have to try to get to your broadcast when I can. Every once in a while, I get a break to come in there, and I really be wanting to stay, but I have to run and stuff, man, because you guys be laying it out, man, and I be like, wow, man, I need to be – I got to figure out a way how I can come to Chicago and just – maybe if I'm sitting in the room with them where I can't go nowhere, maybe
So, oh, yeah. Well, I'm in Detroit, brother, but I travel. I'm in Detroit. But, you know, where my show, my shows are archived on Blog Talk Radio, so people can just go to my website, AfricanHistoryNetwork.com. AfricanHistoryNetwork.com. Yeah, and it has the information about my shows on Blog Talk Radio, and just click on the link there. It takes you to the Blog Talk page, and the shows are archived. So I interview a lot of our top scholars, man. I just had Dr. Phil Valentine on this past Thursday. He's in Hidden Colors 1, 2, and 3. I've interviewed Renoko Rashidi, Professor James Small, Booker T. Coleman, who's one of my teachers, also known as Kappa Hiawatha Kamenei. People have seen him in Hidden Colors 1, 2, and also upcoming Hidden Colors 3. So, I understand that. And so people can either listen live every Thursday, 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, on Blog Talk Radio, or they can catch the archive episodes. And usually on my Facebook fan page, the African History Network, I'll post a link there also so people can go and check that out there as well.
Okay, now suppose someone wanted to book a speaking engagement. How would they go about getting in touch with you?
Okay, well, I can respond fast with the email. Best thing to do, people can email me at events@AfricanHistoryNetwork.com. Events@AfricanHistoryNetwork.com.
You sound like you're kind of breaking up. Are you on a speaker? You sound like you're kind of breaking up a little bit.
I'm on a cell phone, man. I'm almost back home, so when I get home, it should sound clearer. But
okay.
You hear me? Events@AfricanHistoryNetwork.com. Yeah, events, events@AfricanHistoryNetwork.com. Or people can go to my website also and contact me through the website. But, I'm very reasonable. I'll work within your budget. We'll work something out. And I do presentations on all different subjects. One of my latest presentations is understanding the transatlantic slave trade, what they did teach in school. And one of the things I deal with is African people being indigenous to this land, North, Central, and South America, going back at least 51,700 years ago. In this land, it's 56,000 years ago in South America. And actually, July 18th through the 19th, I'll be in Decatur, Georgia, at the Liberated Minds Black Homeschooling Conference. It's their third annual Black Homeschooling Conference. And I'll be doing a presentation there dealing with slavery's back in effect, the hidden relationship between the prison industrial complex, the new voter ID laws, and black population control. And I'll also deal with how corporate entities have major stakes in the prison industrial complexes, privatized prisons, as well as media companies. For instance, the Vanguard, Inc., they're the number one shareholder of Corrections Corporation of America. They own 15,586,000 shares of Corrections Corporation of America, and they're the number three stakeholder in Viacom and Time Warner. And Viacom and Time Warner are two of the six media companies that control 90% of what you read, see, and hear. Okay, so, but I've been studying this man for a long time, so you want to deal with that type of information there. People can go to my website, and then people can also call me 313-462-0003, also. But the easiest way I can respond fast is by email, ahnshow@AfricanHistoryNetwork.com.
Okay. Now, well, let me ask you something, because that little bit of information that you just dropped on us about the prison complex, man, that's some heavy stuff. I've been studying it a little bit, but I don't have everything on it. So now, in your teachings, you can show us how that it was possible for them to make people of African descent the major population inside these prison complexes, is what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You know, we make up about 40% of the prison industry, prison industry. Approximately 2.3 million people in prison. We make up about 40%. Actually, the 2012 numbers, it dropped a little bit, at least for African-American males, dropped down to 793,000. So we see a downward spiral for African-American males, but for African-American females, we see it increasing. But hold on 1 second, brother. Yeah, but absolutely. We can see that, and then and I also deal with the effect that hip hop has also, okay? Because you have to understand hip hop and how hip hop was taken over by a corporate conglomerate to actually understand what's going on, okay? Because hip hop is being used to teach our children that hate themselves, teach our children to engage in drug activity, engage in sex, things like this, okay? And hip-hop was a powerful force. It was a positive force in the late 80s, early 90s. It was very, very positive. You had conscious hip-hop. You had groups like the Four Righteous Teachers. You had groups like Public Enemy, the X-Clan, things like this, okay? They're introducing Malcolm X to our youth. They're introducing Dr. Ben, Minister Farrakhan, things like this, okay? They were teaching us to have a political worldview, all right? And this elevated of our youth. You're going to see, if you look at a lot of hip-hop videos from the late 80s, early 90s, you're going to see a lot of them took place on college campuses. Okay, and what this did was, this showed us the possibility. This got a lot of us to start thinking about college, who never thought about college before. Even if you look at the video by TLC, Baby Baby Baby. Okay, that song took place in a college dormitory. It took place on a college campus. So you had this going on. Then you had shows like A Different World on TV, which is one of the best shows ever, because it showed A Different World showed African-American youth doing positive things week after week after week from all different backgrounds. They were listening to hip-hop. They were educating themselves. They were involved in the community. All right? You're going to see this, and then you're going to see hip-hop change when the corporate conglomerates take it over and send it in another direction, which was gangster rap. See, at one point you had a balance on the radio where you had gangster rap, but you still have Public Enemy and the X-Clan, but that's going to be phased out because positive hip-hop was becoming too powerful, and it was changing the way that the youth thought and changed the way that they acted, okay? And the corporate conglomerates, the power structure, realized that we can't let this happen, so we have to phase this out. And now bands that make them dance. Now, if you look at the hip-hop videos now, like if you watch 106 and Park, if you watch BET, things like that, every third or every fourth video takes place in either a strip club or a nightclub. And what are they doing? They're promoting sex. They're promoting making it rain. They're promoting alcohol. They're promoting drugs, things like this, to our youth through the music. Okay, so we really have to understand, you know, I explain to people, we are at war. We've been at war for over 500 years, at least. The war never ended. The war just changed its format, changed the strategy. But war has been declared on our youth, okay? And since the end of slavery, December 1865, with the 13th Amendment, they've been figuring out what do we do with all these people that we no longer need, because they were using us as a labor force. Those who were enslaved, there were Africans here that, you know, were free, you know, had status, right. whatever status was, whatever tribal nation they belonged to, whether it was Ouachita, Moor, whether, you know, they, you know, whatever tribal nation they belonged to, black Indians, whatever they were. But, you know, this is when, it's after slavery, sometime after slavery, this is when you had the whole eugenics society created, okay, which is trying to figure out how do we control their population. Okay, we no longer need them, all right? And you're going to have the convict lease system introduced, okay, which is going to, like, re-enslave them. You're going to have the black codes, okay? The black codes were laws that were heavy in the South that regulated the former slaves and found ways to tax them, found ways to incarcerate them so that they could profit from the labor. You're going to have the chain gangs, and they're going to be, and you're going to have, you know, convict lease system, things like this. They're going to be utilized to work in the coal mines, okay, which is very, very dangerous work, okay. This is why you had that canary in the coal mine, because the gas levels got too high, the canary would die, and then, you know, they know, okay, we need to get out of here. So they're going to work in the coal mines. They're going to lay railroad tracks for the railroads, things like this. So we have to understand this history, that the prison industrial complex did not just start in, you know, 1982 with the war on drugs by Ronald Reagan, or 1971 with the war on drugs with Richard Nixon. Okay, we can go back and see that even in the 1830s, 1840s, in places like Massachusetts, places like Pennsylvania, that even though African Americans made up 1% or 2% of the free population, they still made up somewhere between 30 to 50% of the prison population. Okay? If people read Black Labor, White Wealth by Dr. Claude Anderson, he lays all this out in there. Okay, so this is history.
Right.
All right? So, yeah, brother, but it is deep, man. I did a presentation back in 2012 dealing with the prison industrial complex, and I've been studying it for a long time. And then the presentation I'm presenting at the conference, July 18th through the 19th, man, I've learned a lot more in those past 2 years since I originally did, brother. I've got the names of the some of the companies that heavily invest in the privatized prison companies, as well as in the media companies. And you know, and what a lot of people don't understand is, in 1980, you had about 50 media companies that controlled 90% of what you read, saw, and heard. Okay, so the magazines, okay, the movies, the TV shows, things like this. Today, you have 6 media companies that control 90% of what you read, see, and hear. Okay, because of the deregulation that took place, I think it was in the 1990s. You see, it used to be that in a particular market, so say like a city like Chicago, Illinois, or Detroit, it used to be that a TV station could not own radio stations in that same market. But because of the deregulation, now you have corporate conglomerates that can own a TV station and a radio station in the same market. And what they did was they went and bought up smaller radio stations, smaller TV stations, things like that. They bought up a lot of African-American-owned TV stations. Well, we had that many TV stations in the first place. But some of the ones we had were bought up. A lot of our radio stations were bought up, okay? So they're controlling this. Then you look at a conglomerate like Clear Channel, okay? Clear Channel has the iHeart app, okay, is on your smartphone. iHeart allows you to listen to Clear Channel radio stations all across the country. All right, if you look at a corporate conglomerate like Viacom owns BET, MTV, and VH1. They show 80% of the music videos that are on cable TV. BET, VH1, and MTV. That's all owned by one company, Viacom. All right.
Wow.
When you look at Walt Disney. Walt Disney owns ABC. Okay. So, you know, ABC News, ABC Network. They own ESPN. All this stuff. So when you start breaking this stuff down, man, and start connecting the dots, and then you look at who major investors in the prison industrial complex, and then you break it down. You look at people like Corrections Corporation of America, CCA. They're the largest owner operator of privatized prisons in the country. They own and operate approximately 67 prisons in the country, okay? Now, Corrections Corporation of America and WACKNHUT is a major owner of privatized prisons also. So now they're known as GEO, okay? These were two of the main entities that pushed for the Omnibus Crime Bill in 1995, 1996, that President Bill Clinton signed into law. They instituted your three strikes and you're out, your truth and sentency laws, things like this, that helped to drive many African Americans into the prison industrial complex. And then you had another entity called ALEC, who was with them, American Legislative Exchange Council. These were the three major entities behind that Omnibus Crime Bill. And during that 8-year period of time, Clinton was in office, you had more African Americans that went to prison during that 8-year period of time than any other 8-year period of time in history. And this was the person that some people, like Tavis Smiley, and Toni Morrison called the first black president. I'm like, you have to look at what happened. We call hell during the Clinton administration. We forget it because he created 23.1 million jobs, and so many people had jobs. But you had many of us that, because of what was known as a Southern strategy, he was trying to see, after his first term, he went moderate. He went more towards the center to appeal to those, you know, Republicans after you had that midterm election and you had the angry white male and Newt Gingrich coming to power, things like that. So this
right.
was an attempt to try to appeal to the Southern Republicans and things like this. So you had that omnibus crime bill, brother. That was death for us. A lot of people don't understand
wow.
how detrimental that was, but that was death for us. Yeah, but I deal with all that, you know, in the presentation. But yeah, the prison industrial
okay.
complex, man. So when people ask, you know, what do you want President Obama to do? First thing he can do is end the war on drugs. That's
right.
the first thing he can do. Oh, because
okay.
because the number one drug that we get arrested for is, do you have to take a break, brother?
Huh? No, go ahead. I'm listening.
Okay, yeah, the number one drug that we get arrested for is marijuana, right? Okay?
Right.
But studies show, like the study from the ACLU, studies show that African-Americans don't use drugs. We don't have a drug usage rate greater than European-Americans. It's almost identical, our drug usage rate. Okay?
Right.
But we get arrested approximately seven times. About seven times more likely to get arrested than white people, even though we have identical drug usage rates. Okay, now if we look at marijuana, and I was just reading an article, man, from theatlantic.com dealing with the neuroscience of drug policies and things like this. If we look at marijuana was legal in America up until 1937. A lot of people don't know this. To understand
yeah,
why marijuana became illegal, yeah, but to understand why marijuana became illegal, you have to study a man named Harry J. Hanslick, who was the chairman of the National Narcotics Commission. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was there were rumors going around that white women craved black men sexually when they were high on marijuana. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now if we understand now marijuana was big amongst your musicians and your jazz singers and things like this, your entertainers, your African American entertainers, things like this, right? So if we understand what our sister Dr. Frances Cress Welton teaches us about how racism comes out of a need to protect genetic white people. They realize if these white women interact with these black men, that they can produce children that are no longer white, okay, phenotypically.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All right?
Right.
So what they did was they criminalized marijuana so to keep these white women away from these men and to criminalize and incarcerate the African Americans who they knew would continue to smoke marijuana. All right? But
okay.
the prohibition does not work, just like they had prohibition of alcohol. Prohibition of alcohol
right.
didn't work. That's why they ended it. It created empire, your Al Capones, your Frank Nitties, all things like this. The Purple Gang here in Detroit, you know, that was a predominantly white Jewish gang called the Purple Gang, and they were notorious
right.
in Detroit. 80% of the illegal liquor that came into the U.S. came through Canada, through Michigan, okay? And the
mm-hmm.
Purple Gang was involved in that, all right?
That's
so,
right.
So when we look at this, you know, prison industrial complex, brother, this thing is really deep, and we have to teach this to our children because they see the videos, they see the fake thug rappers, things like this. They see them in the music video making it ring, and they see the women twerking and things like this, and they think this is what life is about. It's like, no, that's an illusion, okay? And we have to teach them what's going on behind that. But people can check out this article, How Neuroscience Reinforces Racist Drug Policy. Okay, this is from theatlantic.com, all right? How Neuroscience Reinforces Racist Drug Policy. And they break it down, man, about marijuana. They talk about Harry J. Hanslinger in here, things like this. And they, one of the things they talk about is marijuana has particularly frustrating existence in the U.S. There are more people in federal prisons for marijuana offenses than for violent offenses. According to the ACLU, nearly half of drug arrests in 2012 were for marijuana, close to 750,000. And almost half of those arrests were for possession alone, meaning it wasn't for distribution. It wasn't, you weren't selling it, you were just using it, you were just possessing, okay? Almost $4 billion is spent annually on the arrest, prosecution, and incarceration of marijuana offenders, almost $4 billion annually. Now, in police officers in major cities have been talking about how marijuana needs to be legalized because they waste a lot of time going after people who have one or two joints on them as opposed to going after real criminals. So you have police officers saying marijuana needs to be legalized. But what happens is on the other hand, police departments get funding to continue to fight the war on drugs. So as Michelle Alexander, who wrote the New Jim Crow, talks about, they have an incentive to draw out the war on drugs to show a need. You have one group that they have the desire to show a need for a continued protracted war on drugs because they gain more funding, and the prison industrial complex, it creates it employs over 1 million people nationwide, the prison industrial complex, okay? Let me just read a little bit more from this article here. It says, so almost $4 billion is spent annually on the arrest, prosecution, and incarceration of marijuana offenders. And these statistics are egregiously skewed according to race. Police in the biggest American cities like Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York arrest blacks or African Americans for marijuana possession at a rate 7 times greater than their arrest for whites, despite that marijuana use rates do not differ between blacks and whites. So what's happening is the data shows that we have a usage rate of marijuana identical to European Americans, but we get caught, we're 7 times more likely to get caught with it than they are. So because the police operating based on racial biases, stereotypes, things like this, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So this is what happened. Right. This puts us into the prison complex. Now, I'm going to wrap up this article here, but I wanted to see if I could find the quote from Harry J. Anslinger, man, because, see, a lot of people don't know about him, and one of the things I explain to people is Booker T. Coleman, also known as Kaba Kamenei, one of my teachers. He talks about how to understand the existence of something, you first have to understand the pre-existence of existence. So oftentimes on talk shows, I've heard it on Reverend Al Sharpton's show, and even though he's an FBI informant, and I still listen to his show because, first of all, when I criticize him, I want to know what I'm talking about, so I want to know what he said. Secondly, he does sometimes have some good information on there. But I hear people, when they have the debate whether marijuana should be legalized or should it be illegal, 99% of the time, people never talk about the history of why it became illegal in the first place. So
right.
To understand the existence of something, you have to understand the pre-existence of existence and understand why was it made illegal in the first place. What's the history behind this? But it goes on to say, this article goes on to say, it says, neuroscience participates in a sophisticated form of revisionist history. It turns public discourse away from the fact that marijuana is not illegal because it was discovered to cause brain damage, but because of an early 20th century fear-mongering campaign to associate it with Mexican immigrant workers. That campaign infamously led by the first director of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, Harry Anslinger, A-N-S-L-I-N-G-R, Harry Anslinger, culminated in the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937, federal legislation that prohibitively taxed cannabis and hemp, H-E-M-P. Now, hemp is the fiber of the marijuana plant, and they used to make all different types of products from hemp. Everything from whip cords on parachutes to all different types of things from hemp. Anslinger had also become particularly adept at using public media to propagandize the evils of marijuana, okay? So they're, for the most part, manufacturing these evils, okay? They're using a media campaign to shape the way people think, all right? And as we talk about power's ability to define and shape reality and have other people accept your definition of reality as if it were their own. Now, he goes on to say his essay, Marijuana, Assassin of Youth. That was the name of his essay, Marijuana, Assassin of Youth was published in the American magazine that same year. In it, Anslinger offered panic-inducing musings like, quote, how many murders, suicides, robberies, criminal assaults, holdups, burglaries, and deeds of maniacal insanity it causes each year, especially among the young, can only be conjectured. No one knows when he places a marijuana cigarette to his lips whether he will become a joyous reveler in a musical heaven, a mad insanate, a calm philosopher, or a murderer. So what they're doing is just preying on people's fears and misinformation about marijuana, all right? And let me see. Okay,
Hold on one second, Michael. I got a call on the line. Let me open up this line here. Eric, 408. Are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right, what's your question or comment from a guest?
Hey, good day, gentlemen. My name is Jose Omar Bay. And I never found out that we complain so much about pale skin education and the laws and things like that. And yet, how come none of you guys who went to these colleges and brought up the issue that there's a law called the Morse Act, because this is Morse Talk Radio, one, two, the Negro Act of 1780 and 90, which says that blacks and African Americans are, one, not citizens, two, they're not entitled to be equal as people in this country, and three, that as long as we use these terms, that they have a God-given right because they gave us that brand name to treat us as such, and that we, under these auspices, like you said, the pre-existing, that we're always saying blacks and African Americans, but what was the pre-existing terms of why they changed our names and branded it, and then what they call that, patent that name, Tino and Hispanics. I mean, would it not have the same effect as like the medical marijuana story that you just shared, which is a beautiful one because I did the research myself. I was in California when we started the politics to legalize marijuana in California, and so I'm very familiar with that story, so thanks for sharing that with the world. So I'm just curious, on the same legal aspect as the marijuana, would that not fall in the same globalness or the same international spectrum as being blacks and African Americans, because that is a brand name and not a nationality?
Okay, well, Michael, before we let me touch on that before you answer the brother's question. First of all, the way I see it, this is just my personal opinion. Being a more African American, a black, a Negro, colored, to me, none of that makes any difference if you don't have your own government. And this is just my personal opinion, with your own laws, your own nation, your own flag, your own constitution. And to me, what I think that we need to do is start individually as an individual to do the research, come to the conclusion, and take action to do something about our condition regardless of what our race is. Now, that is a very, very valid point you brought up, and I'm certainly grateful that you brought this information out, and we're going to make every effort to try to answer that for you. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, first of all, I never said African American was a nationality. I know it's not a nationality. I'm using it as a general term, just like we may use Hispanic American or European American. That's just a general denotion for a group of people. And I speak to a broad group of people, so I don't want to get caught up in terminology. I don't want to get caught up in nationality, things like this, because I know people who have declared a nationality and got screwed up legally. Okay. So, yeah, I understand we're indigenous people of this land. You have 566 fairly recognized tribal nations in this country and things like this, and we need to reclaim our nationality, what have you. But oftentimes I've seen people get distracted from making their point by getting tied up with terminology, okay? And I don't want to get tied up with terminology dealing with that. The particular act that you're speaking of, I'm not exactly familiar with that one, but I am familiar with the Act of 1740 in South Carolina, the Negro Act, okay, and I'm familiar with the petition of the Free Sundry Moors of South Carolina, 1790. Okay, so I understand that, and I've interviewed Dr. Jose Clemente Bay, and I've read Golden Age of the Moor, things like that. Okay, I'm very familiar with that, the Treaty of Peace of Friendship, 1786 and 1787. All right, so I'm familiar with that. But at the same time, because I speak to a broad group of people, I don't want to get tied up with terminology, okay? That's my response to that.
No, if I may interject one second, because I know we have a lot of listeners and a lot of things going on. Now, it wasn't so much as the terminology, but I'm noticing that we're more concerned about legalizing marijuana and the terminology and the laws of that when we are human beings and that we're being treated as commodity. And that term, black or African-American, is a brand name that's owned by a group or company that entitles them by law to do and treat their product as such. So it's not so much about somebody getting a nationality and going out here to fight the people, nothing like that. But we're saying as on legal terms, because as we were speaking, was on a legal term on how President Clinton did this certain thing, the Jews, the Purple Gang did this certain thing. You know, all these people, we noticed that they're doing certain things. But yet, when it comes to us doing certain things, we lay down under the auspices of black American, African American. We don't want to get into these terms. But yet, no one is talking about the legal identity that gives other people power to do this because we lack the information on the power of the brand name, like the Admiralty Law. And so I was wondering, does that
do you know of any more? Do you know of any Moors that are in prison?
I don't know. I don't do prisons, so I wouldn't say. But I know a lot of Moors
I'm not saying that you've been in prison. I'm saying, do you know any more that have been in prison, went to prison, things like that?
Under the auspices of black and African American, yes.
No, I'm saying being more, because you got a case right here in Detroit. You got three more, they showed their fezzes, all this stuff. You got three more that are brought up on drug charges, and they allegedly escaped, got recaptured, because they're about to go to sentencing. Okay, so what I'm saying is that often, see, I ain't just started studying this stuff yesterday, so I've heard all the arguments. This is why I don't get caught up in the terminology, okay? Because, see, we had a case here in the city of Detroit where a sister was a Moor, and she got stopped by the police out in Redford Township, and she went running her mouth to the police and for what was it? It wasn't a tail light. I think he said her trunk was open or what happened. She went running her mouth to the police, quoting law and statute and all this stuff. He gets on the radio and says, "I need backup. This is a sovereign issue." Well, the problem is that police are on high alert all across the country about sovereignty, because you have police that have been killed and things like this. Not saying this sister was trying to do it, but see, we get caught up in terminology, and then when we get into a situation, we want to quote law and statute and then get even in a deeper issue. So this sister got some real legal problems now, okay? Because let me tell you, see, I don't tell people all this stuff, but I've been in the class dealing with law and all this stuff. You know, I've seen it happen. So she got, because she went out talking about, "I've got rights, I'm more, I've got, you know," quoting statute and all this stuff. And I told her, I said, "Look," because I had a situation where I had a problem with a police officer. Well, I didn't have a problem. I got stopped. Because my plates expired, right? It was my birthday had passed. I was out of town on my birthday, what have you. And everything else was valid. My insurance, my license, all that stuff was valid. So I explained to the officer, I said, "Look, I was out of town on my birthday. I just started a new job. I get paid this Friday. When I get paid, I'm going to get my place renewed." He checked everything. I don't have any warrants, what have you. He said, "All right, go ahead." This was a white Michigan State police officer. Now, if you talk to anybody in Detroit about the Michigan State Police, they have a history of being hard on Moors, blacks, colors, Negroes, African Americans, whatever you want to call it, highly melanated people. He said, "All right." He said, "Look, go ahead and take care of this. I got stopped in Southfield, Michigan. Wasn't even in Detroit." He said, "Go ahead and take care of this." He said, if you get stopped again, they may not let you go. But he said, go take care of this. He let me go. Now, if I started quoting laws and statute and all this stuff, guess what? I probably wouldn't be having this interview with you all right now. So what I'm saying is, the knowledge is fine, but we get caught up in the terminology. We get caught up in a lot of knowledge, and that keeps us from seeing the bigger picture. That keeps us from doing other things. There's a whole lot of knowledge I don't even talk about over the open airwaves. Why? Because I know it's monitored by FBI, CIA, NSA, things like that. There's a whole lot of stuff I don't talk about. So what I'm saying is, you know, knowledge is good, but you have to have the wisdom to know how to utilize the knowledge. Okay, wisdom is that sister companion to the knowledge. It tells you what to say, when to say it, who to say it to, when to be quiet. All right, so, you know, and a lot of us get caught up in the nationality portion, things like this, and still don't own grocery stores, still don't own businesses so we can employ our own people, but we got the nationality. So it's a whole picture that we have to have as opposed to just, you know, one thing. Nationality is important. I agree with that. It is important. Okay, but we have to understand the 360 degrees as opposed to just the 30 degrees.
Okay, well, Michael, I have to agree with you. I'm going to open up the brother's line to see if we're going to conclude the answer to his question. I teach contract law on a regular basis. I am a Moor. That is my legal and political status. However, when it comes to dealing in commerce, I remember one thing that the prophet said. He said, what you do is you don't flash your ID before Europeans because it causes confusion. So what I have done was mastered the law, master contract law, and that is what I use in commerce. The fact that I'm Japanese, Chinese, Mexican, Italian, Moor, none of that means anything because you're going to have to deal with the very laws that you have written. I'm going to point it out where you made a mistake or whatever I have to do to deal with you on a professional basis based on the knowledge of contract law. The whole country operates that way. Now, if
Absolutely.
I look like a Moor, that's fine. That's the way I look. But to come to you to say that you have to do something different because I'm a Moor, no, I don't function that way. So I'm going to open up the brother line and see
right.
if we have concluded the answer to his question.
All right.
Here, code 48. Does that make any sense to you, brother? 48,
We were just trying to just get a broader perspective of what's really going on. Cause this is my first time ever really getting on the radio. Cause I'm heavy into politics, I'm heavy into commerce. I'm very, very excited about watching other people begin to start our own world market and get into our own currency building.
Okay.
I'm a heavy fan.
All right.
Okay. Good.
All right. All right, brother. Well,
all right,
you personally. They stopped me, Mike. They had over 30 police, and I gave them my documents and stuff. It didn't have anything to do with me being a Moor, but one of the older gentlemen came up and he told the rest of them. He said, "Hey, you can do what you want to do. You take him to jail or whatever you want to do, but when he starts suing for
right.
it, he ain't gonna get me. I'm out of here." And him and all 30 police left.
Right.
And it was way long after that before they ever seen me with a fez on. And they said, well, maybe that's because he one of them people. They said, yeah, but he ain't saying nothing about it in him. He opened up a can of whoop butt that we recognize. It ain't got nothing to do with him being a mo. He just beating us with our stick. So that's how that goes.
Right.
Go ahead, brother. Finish.
Right.
Finish,
exactly. So you said it was a long time after that that they saw you with the feds.
Oh, yeah. I had been riding up and down the street doing what I want to do. It was hot out there, and I have a winter fez. I didn't put that on my head. I got out there, put my shelf sleeve shirt on. I ride down the road. But when they stopped me, I let the sheriff know, hey, man, I'm exercising my freedom and right to travel. That's ruled over and over and over by the United States Supreme Court. It didn't have anything to do with your nationality. This is your stick. I'm going to use this on you. And by the time I got through with them, he gave orders to everybody in the city, whatever you do, when you see that little dark-skinned brother right there, don't stop that joker. And then one of them run back down and said, yeah, I don't want one of them hats. He might be one of them people. He said, well, I don't know nothing about that, but don't stop that truck. So that was the end of that.
Right. Because, see, what happens is oftentimes at first, that first officer on the scene, they really don't know a whole lot about law. So, but when you get their superiors coming, many of them are more intelligent. But what I've been told is that the scene of the incident is not the place to debate law. That's what the court is for. Because you may people that don't know what the hell is going on, things like this, man. You know, so that's why you have to be careful of what you say. And I'm telling you, man, 60 Minutes did a story about 3 years ago. And I showed this to people. I have it on one of my hard drives. 60 Minutes did a story about 3 years ago about sovereign citizens. And they talked about how police across the country are on high alert because police officers have been killed, shot at. They've had paper put on them, things like this, by quote-unquote. Now, these are basically white sovereign citizens. Okay, sovereignty and nationality, those are, you know, basically two different things from my understanding of this. But when they talk about these white sovereigns, what happens is when you get that police officer that came out of the academy 6 months ago, all of them are the same. You see what I mean? So this is why you have to be careful what you say, okay? Because, you know, that bullet doesn't have anybody's name on it, but it may find you. So I'm telling you, man, I tell people, you know, and this is why, like, this is why I don't tell everybody this type of information, because this defamation is not for everybody. You have to have a certain level of maturity to handle this type of information, because you can go out here and get yourself in a world of trouble that you aren't prepared to get yourself out of.
That's right. Well, I try to tell y'all, brothers and sisters, to master contract law, how to handle yourself on the streets. Number one, you don't want to waste any time with the guys with the guns and badges. These are private contractors. And go ahead and do what you got to do out there and protect yourself until you can get back home and then do up your documents and stuff. I don't go inside their courtrooms long before we could ever possibly get there. The war is over, and I won, because I'm going to take Rome's stick, and I'm going to just put that out there and just tell them, say, well, you know, you, isn't this what you put right here? Isn't this in your law and stuff? Well, this is what we have over here, and I'm not dealing with the Indians. I only want to deal with Sitting Bull himself. And when we together to deal with that, then that's the end of that. There's no need to go to court. And so, but my nationality doesn't have anything to do with commerce. And the reason why I separated the two is because the Prophet Noble Drew Ali said, do not flash your identification before Europeans, it causes confusion. So I don't want any confusion, but whatever is on the books and what rights I have, these are the rights I'm going to enforce, and I'm going to do it according to the law. Now, when it comes to my nationality, we're talking about a human rights violation, or if we're talking about the rights of indigenous people before the International Courts of Trade, then that's a whole different ball game, and I will bring cabinet members for my government. So we got groups and organizations of Moors all across the country trying to function with power without an existing government, and that's very, very difficult to do. So that's all
absolutely
I want to add on that. I'll be on your broadcast Thursday night at 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
I'll be dialing in at 10 o'clock, and whatever questions you got,
yeah,
I'll be willing to ask them. But go ahead and continue, man, about this marijuana and this industrial complex and this prison stuff, because we need to know this stuff, man.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, you know, let me continue briefly here with this article, see where I left off. Okay, since his essay, Marijuana Assassin of Youth, was published in the American magazine that same year, in it, Anslinger offered, okay, we dealt with that. Sensationalism like this was specifically aimed at a white readership that might worry about such an unfathomably dangerous ethnic drug getting into the hands of its children. So it was really associated with Mexicans and black people, African Americans, okay, Negroes back then. It was associated with them. You have your entertainers, your jazz singers, things like this, okay? Let's see. Okay, so Okay, Anslinger's congressional testimony directly betrayed his racist motivations to enact federal legislation against marijuana. Quote, there are 100,000 total marijuana smokers in the U.S., and most are Negroes, Hispanics, Filipinos, and entertainers, end quote, he said. Their satanic music, jazz, and swing, which is a form of dance for those who too young remember swing, okay, well, swing and swing music also. So I think we created swing, but then they made Benny Goodman the king of swing, you know, just like they made Elvis Presley the king of rock and roll. That came from us, all right?
Right.
So, okay, but their satanic music, jazz, and swing result from marijuana usage, okay? This marijuana causes white women to seek sexual relations with Negroes, entertainers, and any others, end quote, all right? So this is the motivation behind the marijuana laws that are sending brothers and sisters to prison to this day, all right? Because marijuana was legal up until about 1937. We really have to understand history, and we have to teach this to our children so they don't fall into these booby traps. We have to explain to them about the prison industrial complex, explain to them that this is the new slavery. Slavery, you know, didn't end with the 13th Amendment. It just changed its form, because the 13th Amendment states that involuntary slavery is prohibited unless duly convicted of a crime. All right, so, you know, many people, man, they don't understand the entities that are out here, whether it's ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, the Corrections Corporation of America, and actually a couple years ago, in February of, I think it was 2013 or 2012, Corrections Corporation of America, they sent letters to 48 states because they wanted to purchase prisons in 48 states across the country. And one of the stipulations because what they wanted to do is they wanted to purchase the prison, okay, and then they wanted to have a management contract with the state, like a 10-year, 15-year management contract. So they wanted the state to then pay them to manage the prison, okay? But one of the stipulations was that they wanted to be guaranteed at least 90% occupancy in these prisons, all right? So what that caused a lot of people to fear is that then you would have harsher laws put on the books and harsher sentences given out at the federal level, at the city judges, what have you, that would then cause the state to live up to their obligation to keep 90% occupancy in these prisons that they sell to Corrections Corporation of America. All right, so, you know, I've got articles and all this stuff, man, and you know, this is really deep. So this is one of the reasons why we have to educate our children. This is one of the reasons why we have to create businesses for our own people so that we can employ them so they don't have to turn to criminality, okay, and get caught in this system.
That's right.
And we have to have these businesses so we can employ our brothers and sisters who come back home from prison, because 95% of the people in prison eventually will be released. Okay,
that's right.
So if we don't have businesses so we can employ them when they come out, most of them are going to go back because there won't be anything sustaining. You know, right now you're dealing with about 55% of African-American college graduates who graduated within, I think, about the last year or so. You have they're either unemployed or underemployed, okay? And I have, I don't know if I'll be able to find articles on that.
Hold on a second. Let me bring area code 412 in. 412, come on in.
Okay.
How you doing, brother Michael? How are you?
Hey, sister. How you doing? All right, how you doing?
Good. I listen to your show. I love your show. I was listening to you at the beginning of your breakfast when you came in, and you were talking about that Anslinger guy, and it brought back some memories. It brought back some memories. When I was in undergrad here in Pittsburgh, Dr. Barbara Sizer was my mentor, and she took me to the Black Studies Conference in I can't remember where it was. It's been so long, but it changed my life because, you know, all the people that I read about, Alicia Asante, Malana Karenga, they were all there at this Black Studies Conference in 1992, St. Louis, Missouri. And I was in a small group workshop, and this older sister came. Now, back then I was in my 20s, or no, I was 1920, and this older sister came in, and she gave this workshop on prison. And as she was finishing, she started crying, and she said to us in the group, she said, "Do you all know that the prison system is changing?" And she said, "I am a social worker, a licensed social worker. I go into these prisons and meet with women that they're arresting now. And the female population is growing." And she said, "Now they're permitting the women to have children in prison so that they can train our children to think that prison is normal and start that generation off in prison." This is what she told us in 1992, and look where we are now. And then last summer I was at the August Wilson Theater down here in Pittsburgh, and they showed the movie American Promise. And it showed the beginning of heroin and cocaine and marijuana and all those uses, all those drugs being used initially by white folks. When, you know, different nationalities started using them, they outlawed them, and that's what you were talking about. However, they had this ex-police officer on there talking, this white racist police officer, and he said, you know, the three strikes you out was meant for black men and black people, he said, and then the 100-to-1, you get, you know, 100 years for an ounce of crack cocaine as opposed to a pound of powder, which white people have. And he said that President Obama just recently changed some things with that sentencing from 100-to-1 to 18-to-1 because white males are selling methamphetamine. Is that what it's called? Yeah. They're getting caught up in the so-called drug game now. And white men are being locked up. I'm talking life in prison for the white guy. They should got three. You had 3 ounces of meth. He got life. And what this white man cop said was, we can't lock up white men, so we have to change the laws. And it goes back to what Dr. Wellstein said. They, you know, if the white men are locked up, they can't reproduce. And if the white women are going after the black man, white people are in trouble. And this ex-cop had the audacity to say, white people are being marginalized. Things have to change. And so now that their laws are affecting them, they're trying to change them. So I thought what you were saying was very, very, very prevalent and right on point. And I agree with it.
Oh, thanks, sister. Thanks for calling in. I appreciate that.
Okay, Thank you.
No problem. Hang on, Lisa,
and we're going to continue.
Okay. That article dealing with the unemployment rate amongst African-American college graduates, this article is from AfricanGlobe.net. They have a lot of good articles here, AfricanGlobe.net. More than half of black college graduates underemployed. More than half of black college graduates underemployed. May 26th. 2014, this is just last month, says a whopping 55.9% of black graduates are underemployed, taking jobs far below their educational level. In 8 of the 13 major categories, the researchers write, black recent college graduates that find a job were more likely to end up in a job that did not require a four-year degree than in one that did. And such jobs, such as those in the restaurant and retail sectors are increasingly low pay. But, you know, this is directly, and they go on to say, even black graduates entering the science, technology, engineering, and math fields, also known as STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math fields, where employees are both highly sought and highly paid, suffer a 10% underemployment rate and a 30 and a 10% unemployment rate and a 32% underemployment rate. Okay, so basically what this shows is once again the need for us to, number one, support our own businesses. About 98% of our dollars are spent with people that don't look like us. So number one, to support our own businesses. Number two, to create more businesses so we can employ our college graduates, so we can employ brothers and sisters who are coming back home from prison, so we can employ people and keep them from going to prison as well. See, every ethnic group in America are the largest employers of their own people, except us, all right? And this is, and unfortunately, many of your so-called civil rights leaders, or the people I refer to as your Negro leaders and civil rights superstars, they're not talking about this, okay? They have us out marching for jobs and justice and all kinds of other nonsense. They aren't talking about us becoming the number one employers of our own people. We can look at this article here from, go ahead.
Let me open up this other line.
Let me get this other article right quick. This other article, this is from financialjuneteenth.com. But just check out this article. Black male teens in Chicago have a shocking 92% unemployment rate. This is from June 1st, 2014, just 3 weeks ago. Black male teens in Chicago have a shocking 92% unemployment rate. They're talking about African-American males 16 and 19 years old. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Area code 972, come on in. Tell us who you are, where you're calling from, what's your question or comment?
Hey, Brother Tahaka, this is Sharon Hunter calling out of Dallas. And
okay, Sharon.
I'm enjoying your show, and I just wanted to, when the brother put that latest figure out, 10 of the graduates from colleges being underemployed, I just had to tone in on that because I am definitely in that 59% of people. I actually have two bachelor's and a master's degree, and I'm working at a position right now that I could have worked at just coming straight out of high school. It doesn't require any type of degree whatsoever to work in. And I'm making less money
absolutely
on this than I made when I came out of school 20 years ago.
And that's 55.9%, just to be honest.
Oh, okay.
55.9%. But what this deals with, what this relates to, number one, is, you know, discrimination and hiring that relates to it. But also, I always encourage people to read the book, How White Folks Got So Rich, The Untold Story of American White Supremacy. How White Folks Got So Rich, The Untold Story of American White Supremacy. And in the book, they talk. One of the things they talk about is how approximately 8 out of 10 jobs in the private sector are never publicized, okay? So the people who work for the company, they find out about those jobs first. The majority of these people are European-American or white, so they tell their friends, the people in their network about them, so most of those jobs go to European-Americans. We're locked out. And because we have become, over the years, overly dependent upon government jobs, a lot of that had to do with the Civil Rights Act of 1964, okay, because in affirmative action in September of 1965, because affirmative action started with the government jobs, okay? So those were the jobs like the post office. We've always heard the saying is always work at the post office. Those government jobs were the ones that gave us the fairest shot most of the time. So today, 50% of African Americans with college degrees work for some form of government, whether it's city, county, state, or federal government, and 68 to 70% of African Americans in general work for some form of government. Okay, but unfortunately, you know, we don't listen to Dr. Claude Anderson. Many of us we're listening to, you know, the NAACP and the Urban League and National Action Network that have us out marching for jobs and justice and look for other people to do for us what we should be doing for ourselves, okay? Yes, everybody else had government help, and we should push for that. Those who did vote for President Obama, if you voted and you're not pushing for something for your vote, just like every other interest group, every other ethnic group, whether it's the LGBT community, whether it's Hispanics and immigration, things like this, those who did vote, okay, you should be pushing for something else for your vote as opposed to a photo op or riding in the motorcade. So we have to really, you know, we really have to understand what's going on. I also recommend people read blackenterprise.com, read that website, and get Black Enterprise magazine, because that would help really take your business game to the next level and help to really orientate you to entrepreneurship, small business management, things of this nature.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I've been reading that for 20 years since I was in college. Go ahead, sister.
Lisa, you have another comment for the question for the guest? Are you with me?
I was just listening. I'm still there. I'm still here. I'm listening to Brother Imhotep because he has so much knowledge, and I'm another one of those. I'm actually not employed by choice because I was working in the school district here, and I quit because the kids were so bad and there was no accountability. But I have two master's degrees, and I was making what I made without any degree, like Sharon. And every time I even stopped the superintendent of the school, she brought her little narrow behind to a breakfast at the school. I said, "Can I ask you? This is a Black woman locked down to her hips. You would think she would say more than she did." I said, "I've applied for 52 positions in the district, and I worked for this district for 12 years in a position, and our positions were cut when the governor, you know, cut the funding to education." And I said, every time I apply, I am told we found someone more qualified. This is how racist it is. I worked a summer program as an assistant site director. The lady in charge of that program called me the following year. She emailed me the following year and said, "Lisa, do you want your position back?" I said, "Let me think about it," because the kids were awful and I didn't want to take my summers doing this job. And then I emailed her. I said, "Yeah, I could use the $4,000 for a month. I'll do it." She took another job in the process of putting my name in for that position. She took another job in another state. They hired another Caucasian woman. This woman said, "Oh, we found someone more qualified. We will not need you for the position." You tell me it's not some racism going on there. I worked the position, but somebody was more qualified.
This is what
they do. And so I will not apply for any more jobs in this school district. I have come to the terms with myself that I will build my own real estate business, in which I'm doing right now, and do other things. And I listen to Brother Taharka's Wealth Building Show. I'm not going back to work for them. And the more of us decide to do that, the more of us that, and build up our communities again, the better off we'll be. But we let civil rights stuff get into our system. Oh, we need them. Look at our neighborhoods.
Right.
We followed that stuff and took our money right out of our neighborhoods. And now that white folks are coming back, and I live in the middle of quite a few bad neighborhoods. I saw a white woman riding her bike in one of the worst neighborhoods in the city. She was riding her bike. That is a sign.
Yep.
Two years ago, she wouldn't have been doing it.
We're down to the last 2 minutes, 6 minutes, y'all. We're down to the last 6 minutes.
I'm going to open up one more line
and ask them to be brief, and then we can close on down. Erico 202, come on in. Please be brief if you got a question for my guest.
Hey, how you doing?
Can you hear me? What's your question, brother? Yeah, we hear you loud and clear.
I'm talking about most people. If we got to wake up. Anytime you see them riding the bikes, you start seeing the other things, they're going to take the community over. And next thing you know, there won't be no jobs for us or nobody else. So we better get on board and start. I mean, the hardest part is to start something and try to do something after you've been doing something for a while, for years, the same process. When you break away from that job, you wonder, what have I done? And then you got some of us who have heart attacks, strokes, and when we lose the job, like my buddy's father, he lost a job. After that, he had a heart attack, and then he had two strokes, and next thing you know, we're out of here. But we got to get in the habit of kind of build up communities, not work for nobody else, and just tough it out. And we got to learn to support each other.
You know, right,
brother. That's what the culture does.
Erico 757, come on in. 757. What's your question? 757, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
What's your question,
my dear? Can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you loud and clear.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Wonderful. Peace and love, everyone. My name is Sister Bakira Shabazz L. from Fort Bend, Virginia.
My question
is, listening to what the sister had to say about the job and everything like that, it is extremely discouraging. But when we have people who know how to set us free, and we have to, you know, pay for everything, it makes it that much harder. If we can start our own businesses and get out of these contracts, then we can contribute to our own communities and to our own causes. But we're steadily trying to pay people for, like, freedom documents when we already don't have the money. And what I don't understand is why is that, especially when we have sovereign European groups that's giving out various information, because the Europeans are fed up as well. They're just giving out information that's been telling on the government, especially ones that used to work for the government. They're coming out and spilling everything. But when it comes to us, we have to charge for the basic things that keep us in these agreements. Why is that?
Well, hold on. Let me hold that in a minute, Michael. We only got 3 minutes left. Sister, as far as I'm concerned, what I do is I follow the principles and techniques that I was taught when I was young, and I learned some things from a millionaire involving his own son, and he said in spite of the fact that he's rich, what he does is he makes his son earn everything. What we're doing is we're not only teaching people, but we're investing our time and we're putting forth the information. I started out giving away information a long time ago, and I discovered that when I gave people something that they didn't earn, they didn't do anything with it. And so what I did was I set up a system where they can donate to it, and I'm only interested in the people who are serious about what they're doing. So people who tell me that we need to give away things, I always tell them, well, let's get together, let's go over to Walmart and tell them white folks that they need to start giving us everything there. I don't have a whole lot of time, but I don't charge for anything, but what we do, we put information up where the serious people who are really wanting to actually change their lives can actually do something with the information. I spent thousands of dollars, I'm talking about thousands, investing in making DVD discs, getting in my truck, putting gas in it, riding around to all of my people, giving out information. But I come back next week, I'm still in the same position. I hope that answers your question. So I'm going to sign on off because it's time for us to get off the air. Michael, we got an hour, a minute and 44 seconds. I certainly appreciate you being in.
No problem, brother. I encourage people to go to my website, AfricanHistoryNetwork.com, AfricanHistoryNetwork.com. We have wide selection of DVDs there, all my lectures also. And thanks to Harker for coming on. And tune in to the African History Network show Thursdays, 8 p.m., 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time right here on Blog Talk. On my website and my daily show, Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on TuneIn.com on the Empowerment Radio Network.
Okay, well, I certainly appreciate it. Also, I will be on the African History Network show Thursday night. I'll be coming in about 10 o'clock, so I'll look to see everybody in the place.
Yeah.
And, Michael, I certainly appreciate you being on my broadcast, and I'll see you Thursday night.
Okay, brother, thanks. I appreciate it, man. Hold tough. Have a good night, okay?
All right. Ladies and gentlemen,
right,
you've been listening to Morris Talk Live 100, and our special guest, Michael I Am Horsey's Help, has been with us, and we will see each other Thursday night. I've been your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, so you all have a good evening, okay?
Hey, baby. Listen.
when I feel it's right.
When I get my groove,
oh, baby, I know you feel the flame. The way you're holding me tonight. Be sure that you're for real.
Get my love.
When you get my love. No, I don't play no game. That's the way it is. Hey, baby, that's the way it is. You see, so many doing that wild thing. Baby, taking all kinds of chances. You see, it's dangerous out there. When you're dealing with all kind of romance. That's why, when I love, I love.
Baby, when I love.
Oh, it's just one love at a
when
time.
When I get this groove on.
You got to give it to only me, baby. If you want to be mine. Be sure.